Greetings, everyone. Welcome to all of our guests who have come from a pretty far distance away today. Seen some faces from up around the Little Rock area, it seems to me, and a lot of the Fort Worth people and some brand new people who are here for the first time, and from Canada again. And we also have people here from Paris, France, and from Los Angeles, California. So before I make some of those introductions, let me tell you a little bit about what happened last weekend. We've already written a letter which will be going out to the entire mailing list, and I think the telephone brigade has been very busy. I know it has in the Worldwide Church of God. We went out to Arcadia, California, and I could not have been more moved, inspired, overwhelmed, and overjoyed by what I encountered when I walked into that hall. When I first walked in, here were many old friends that I hadn't seen for many months, in some cases about 4 or 5 years, including many of the ministry, some of those men who have been in very important responsibilities in past years in God's work and who are very well known throughout the Worldwide Church of God. I was dumbfounded and overwhelmed, to say the least, but there they were. First of all, I suppose I should say that I would go alphabetically if I could sort them all out right quickly, because I don't wish to illustrate a pecking order, but it was really great to see Mr. and Mrs. Charles Ullman, and of course Mr. and Mrs. Ben Chapman there, and then Mr. and Mrs. David Antion. You know that Molly is my wife's sister, and David Antion has been one of the four men, and of those four, three are with the Church of God International, who have been at the vice presidential level as directors of the entire ministry of the United States, head of the Pastoral Administration Department. So here was Mr. and Mrs. David Antion. Mr. and Mrs. Wayne Cole were there. Mr. and Mrs. Albert J. Portoon were there for the services. Mr. and Mrs. Gary Arvidson were there. Mr. Arvidson is a graduate of Brickett Wood and one of the very fine preachers in the church. And he had also been out of touch with the church for about these 4 years. But like so many of the ministry and, I believe, the lay membership, who for various reasons may have dropped by the wayside, or I would prefer to say for various reasons were pushed out of the Church of God at various times, these people had not left their knowledge and belief in God. They had not left their practice of observing God's Sabbath day. They had certainly not left God, even though they had not been in constant fellowship with the church. So it was really a red-letter day to have all of these men there and so many people. Now, I thought that we had about 500 because they'd set up about 550 chairs, and I didn't think there were more than 50 empty chairs, even though the Pasadena Star News reported 400, so I don't want to be guilty of exaggerating crowds, but most of the people there told us about 500 brethren. The tape of that sermon is, of course, available on the tape program. I spoke basically about unity in the church and the church needing all of her children and the great job there is to do ahead of us, and of course couldn't help but refer to what had happened a little bit, not in a negative sense, but in the sense of what is now beginning to occur of many men in the church standing shoulder to shoulder to do God's work. Well, that night we had a very moving dinner at which I think 31 people were present, including some of the really cherished people. There's a couple or two that I can't identify quite yet, because if I did, they would get cut off without another dime, and I think they would hope to be given normal severance pay, if that is normal anymore. But it was really great to have them there. There was a beautiful Mexican restaurant out in West Covina, one of the most beautiful I've ever seen. I'd never heard of it before, with interior fountains and adobe walls and gorgeous planting. And we had a whole exterior courtyard, kind of an open-air room, all to ourselves, 31 of us, and had a fantastic dinner that night, visiting and fellowshipping together. It was unbelievable to sit right across the table from Al and Dareth Portoon and from Wayne and Doris Cole. And here were Dave and Molly Antion and Mr. Tom Justice and his wife and Bob Justice and his wife and Gary Antion and his wife over here. And it was just as if all of these years had never occurred. Like all of a sudden, here we were back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and it was all of the vice presidents and members of the board of trustees and some of the leading ministers in the Church of God who were seated around this table. And you know, when I begin to think of what the Feast of Tabernacles preaching schedule is going to look like this year, and I think here's going to be men like the ones that I have mentioned, and I could certainly add some more, like perhaps add Garner Ted Armstrong and Ronald Dart and a few other people to that preaching schedule of C. Wayne Cole and David Antion and Al Portoon and Gary Arvidson and Ted Phillips and on and on and on, Mr. Ullman and Mr. Chapman and Gary Arvidson. I begin to think, What's it going to be like to go to the feast at one of the big feast sites? Who's going to be speaking to these people? But I'm sure there will be a fine preaching schedule there, too, and I don't mean to put them down. There's some wonderful preachers and ministers in the Worldwide Church of God, and we all know that, and we do believe it. But there's some very wonderful ministers who are coming to help, and not of their own choice, I might add. And you'll hear a little more about that today. I don't believe that any one of those people simply leapt over and said, I'm going to volunteer to follow some other man. Not a one of those people is following Garner Ted Armstrong anywhere. But they're standing shoulder to shoulder with me, and together we're all going in the same direction. And that is what is important. I'd like to make a couple of brief introductions today. The first gentleman who is going to speak to you does not speak English. His heart is the same as yours. The knowledge in his heart is identical to yours. He is a member of the Church of God International over in France. They have, of course, started their own association over there. They have to because of governmental constraints. I'd like to introduce for a brief moment to say hello to you in his own tongue, Mr. Wieserbeke. Would you like to come and say hello?
Bonjour.
Hi, everybody.
Good morning.
No, afternoon.
Alors, je suis les yeux, les oreilles pour le groupe français Église Internationale de Dieu.
He's acting as a chairman for the French Association in France, and he's the eyes and the ears of this association, and he says a big hello for all of you from France, Belgium, and Switzerland.
On veut vous remercier, Monsieur Bourdin et moi, pour l'accueil qui nous a été réservé, et nous souhaitons que cette église grandisse et qu'enfin puisse jaillir la lumière.
We want to thank you most heartily, all of you, for your welcome here. We appreciate your welcome, and we are with you with all our heart, and we need your prayers and your help. Okay.
Thank you. He was still translating for Mr. Wieserbeke. And now the translator, a man that I have known for at least 15 years, I guess, by now. We've attended conferences together in Pasadena and over in Geneva and up in the mountains in Switzerland at Kranz. And have spent many enjoyable, memorable hours with this gentleman who's been in God's work for many, many years. When he first had the office in Switzerland, he was working in translating in the mailing department. He's been a professional translator for about 20-some years of his life. Of course, has been born, reared, grown up in France, from Paris, France, Etienne Bourdin.
Well, greetings, everybody. That remembers something, you. All right, I want to tell you something you know in the Psalms. I think you pronounce it. I wish I could speak like Mr. Ted Armstrong. Well, you know, in the Psalms there is a verse which says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. Well, you will be afflicted. You are going to hear me speak. Your tongue. See? I presume you know the story of the Englishman. You know this kind of fellow Englishman, yes? Coming over to France for the first time in his life, and he has a notebook, and he sees a red-haired girl for the first time. You know what he jots down in his diary? He says, in France, all girls are red-haired, you know? And maybe you had the impression that all French people were like Monique Conseil when she came. No, you see, we are not as swarthy. All right, okay. She's going to hear it. I will get to, well, you know. another thing you may not know, France has been called, since Clovis, I think, that's way back, she's a bit older than I even, you see, she was called France the eldest daughter of the Catholic Church. Well, that's theoretical. There are only about 80% people who are Catholic in France, but that's a theory. In practice, there are about 15%. But still, it is a reason why they don't know their Bible. They are not Protestant, they are Catholic, and they don't know their Bible. And it's a big drawback, you know. They don't know the Bible, as you do. And as Mr. Armstrong said, I am a translator, I have been for not 20 years, but 39 years, but I am not interpreter, that's another thing. It's quite a different job. I would like to tell you about the people who have been disfellowshipped in France. About 15 officially, formally, but in reality, about three times as many. You must keep that in, bear that in mind. And these people meet from time to, I mean, every Sabbath in different places, sometimes in north of France or in Paris, in the homes of, they act as hosts, you know, in the homes of one member. We have no building as you have. It's even forbidden or badly considered if we sing hymns. You see, it's like this over there. If they here sing psalms or hymns, it's bad taste. That's what they call it like there. And we meet every Sabbath and in different places at the same time. So there is a problem there. I'm the only minister. So we have other people who read the sermons. I translate the sermons from Mr. Ted Armstrong, and they hear it, or it is summarized, and they hear the sermons, and they have not the advantage. You have got to see him in vivo, as you say. We need your prayers a good deal, and your help, because we are so scattered, and so our means are very low, but our hearts are with us. We are fully with you, you know. And I think you pray for us, I am sure. And I wish, my biggest wish would be that you would be, that we should be as many people as you are here for the whole of France. But as I told you in the beginning, we are only about 40 at most for the time being. But still, in spite of this, we are going to have a nice Feast of Tabernacles at the same time as you do, in spite of people who have said that we do not observe now annual Sabbath and so on. We do. We did it for Passover. We are going to do it for the Pentecost and so on. So I thank you again for all your welcome, and my heart is with you, and thank you, really. Thank you.
He referred, of course, to my introduction of Miss Monique Consul, in which I merely said, we have a young lady from Paris, France. Of course, Monique is a black girl from, I believe, originally the West Indies, and, of course, in one of the French islands there where she grew up speaking French. I understand today she's down in Sri Lanka at the southern tip of India for vacation. She works for the airlines and gets to travel at 10% of the ticket cost. So if she hears this a little later on, well, our hearts are with you too, Monique, and all the other brethren and the sisters over there in Paris, France, and scattered around Europe. Now, for the remainder of the service, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome among us a gentleman that I have known since we were little tiny boys. I don't know when we first met. It is too vague in my mind, but he used to attend the Scrabble Hill, Jefferson, Oregon church with his family. His father was a member of the original board that ordained or gave credentials to my father, Herbert W. Armstrong. His father's name was on many of those early church documents, rather. And I believe that some of our acquaintances, or some of the older names in the Church of God, Seventh Day, and the Radio Church of God are very similar. Of course, as you know, he came to Ambassador College and was there prior to my being discharged from the Navy. When I first came in as a freshman, he was my student body president. For many years thereafter, in the ministry of Jesus Christ, I think for about 14 years, wasn't it, in Australia? 11 years in Australia. And then he has been director of the entire ministry in the churches in Canada, and has been at the vice presidential level, a member of the Board of Trustees, and director of pastoral administration in the United States. He can tell you the rest of the story as to what happened in about December and January of this last year. Long after my ouster, Mr. Cole was working alongside my father. He has traveled to Tucson many, many times. He has seen, talked to, been on the telephone with, and sat in the living room and study of my father many hours, long since the last time I ever heard from him. So here to tell you about what happened and about himself and why he is here today, Mr. Cyril Wayne Cole.
Thank you very much, Ted. And it is okay if I say Ted, or should I refer? Last night, two things happened. Well, I should say only one. Perhaps there were many more than that, but one that I want to refer to, then another one this morning. The word obviously has spread, and a man from Western Union called last night and said, I have a telegram for you from Little Rock, Arkansas. I jotted it down quickly. The copy has not been mailed out. I think they're mailing it to the hotel, so I'll have it later for any files or notebooks that I want to put together. But it said, we thank God for you and for your continued service in his work from the Little Rock Church. Now, that's from the Little Rock Church of the Church of God International. And I don't know who they are. I wouldn't have any idea who sent the telegram, who's responsible. Benny Sharp mentioned a name to me. Since They've already forgotten that. But at a time like this, and I'll comment on that in a few minutes, that's particularly encouraging to me. And then this morning, I called over to the office and to see if perchance someone would answer. I had tried to call Benny. His number was busy. No complaint about that, Benny, but I wanted to get directions on how to come to church today. And a lady answered the telephone, and she said she had a telegram there for me. So this is addressed to me from the Congregation of the Church of God International at Pocahontas, Arkansas, my wife's home state. The message says, "We of the Pocahontas Congregation heartily welcome you to the Church of God International. We are anxious to get on with the work of God, and we feel that you will be a great asset." And it's signed, Church of God International, Pocahontas, Arkansas. Well, I appreciate their confidence, appreciate their comment, and that also is tremendously encouraging. I don't know whether you can fully appreciate this or not. I think perhaps all of you can in some degree. At least I would believe so. But in me right now is a certain amount of anxiety, I guess is perhaps the best way to say it, nervousness, butterflies in my stomach, perhaps even a certain amount of fear. I don't mean reservation. I don't have any reservation about what I'm doing. I have no reservation about being here today. I haven't the slightest doubt in my mind that I'm doing exactly what God wants me to do. But in spite of being able to say that, it isn't easy to take certain steps to make decisions, and for those decisions to give the appearance, at least superficially, to people who wish to take it that way, and for the distortions and so on, to be in rebellion against something that I have believed in for so long. I hope, at least, would like to believe, that I was a sincere, I hope hardworking, dedicated member of the ministry of the Church of God, and have been for most of those years, at least, that I had the opportunity to serve. And I have great admiration, great respect for the man, Herbert W. Armstrong, have had for many years. As Ted has said, in perhaps a rather unique way, in the church today, had the opportunity as a little boy to go along with my parents when I was 6 and 7 years old to Connor School or Deaver School, the Jefferson Creamery, places that have been mentioned in the autobiography, later to the Scrabble Hill Schoolhouse, and then the church bought that property where the old schoolhouse was and built a church. As a little kid, I nailed many nails into the framework and the structure that now sits there on Scrabble Hill near Jefferson, Oregon. That is the meeting house of the Church of God Seventh Day in that area. And I've sat in that building and listened to this man preaching from the stage in the pulpit with great enthusiasm and great dynamics and very forceful, and sort of grew up on that. I would listen at home, not by choice necessarily, but when it's blasting through the house, I couldn't help it, but hear the programs of the radio Church of God. I've heard the quartet singing on the program that Mr. Armstrong did in those days. I've forgotten some of the names of the people who sang, but I've heard that, cut my teeth on it in a way, and grew up on it. Read the bulletins and the letters, or at least looked at them and saw them when they came into the house, though I didn't spend too much time reading it. My interest did not lie in religion. Particularly, I was looking forward to growing up and getting old enough to be able to kick over the family traces. I tried to do that when I was 18 years old, worked for a couple of years, included working on the Sabbath, found out that wasn't exactly all it was cracked up to be, and so on and so on. But anyhow, there's a great background. As Ted has said, as little boys, we had the occasion to spend a fair amount of time together. We did not live in the same city, hence there wasn't the developing kind of relationship or friendship that you might have with a neighbor kid. But Ted and Dick were people that I knew, and they were people that I enjoyed seeing on the occasion when they would come to our area. In 1950, when I went to Ambassador College, Dick Armstrong became my very closest personal friend. He wrote in the first envoy, which I still have, that was done, Dick was the editor, and it was published, I think, in 1952 is the date that's on it. And on my picture, Dick said, "To the greatest buddy I've ever had," I think are his words. And I cherish those words. He's no longer with us. And I mean literally, I think he would be with us if he were alive. And right here, if not in this auditorium, certainly with us in the work and in spirit and attitude and in the effort that will be done by us all together. But I cherish all that background. But growing up that way and being a part of the Cole family that has been a part of the Church of God for a lot longer than I've ever been born, my dad and mom, my dad was baptized in 1915. My mother's parents were married in Jerusalem and lived in Jerusalem for much of their life. And my mother's uncle, on the paternal side, her father's brother, was a minister in the Church of God Seventh Day for many years, going back into the late 1800s. And he died somewhere about 1934, 35, somewhere thereabouts. And so the roots go way back. And many, many memories. My father, as Ted said, was a part of the Oregon Conference and on the board was later an elder, a lay elder, a local elder in the church. He did not preach, but he gave Bible readings, organized certain parts of the service, and so on. But when I went to Ambassador College, it was not by choice. I was persuaded by Mr. Armstrong I didn't have to go into the ministry. That was a big step right there. And Dick persuaded me to go, plus the fact the Korean War was on, and I wasn't too anxious to go to war. And I could be deferred as a student by going to college. So I had the papers half filled out to go to the Navy, but instead of that, I went to Ambassador College. Came out in 1954 as a graduate. Didn't want to go to the ministry. Mr. Armstrong said, "We think that's where God has called you." And so it was off to Corpus Christi, Texas. And then the story developed from there. I've never looked back with any regret whatever, any sorrow or any remiss that was the course of life that I was privileged to follow. I would never have chosen it. The very idea, in words only, to say that this is a CWC minister was not appealing to me. But references to the things we were able to do, the lives we were able to be involved with, the people that were able to be helped, those that would come to you and thank you with deep expressions of gratitude for the services performed on their behalf, all of that made it very much worthwhile. And thankfully, the record is strewn not mostly with unpleasant experiences, but mostly with pleasant experiences. And I'm thankful for that. The worm turns, as they say. Trails and pathways sometimes become very, very crooked. I don't mean crooked in the corrupt sense, but there are many turns that one makes along the way. I never believed 6 months ago that I would be here with you. I didn't have anything against you. I knew that there were some very fine people that would be meeting here in Tyler on any given Sabbath and other places. And I also think before God, I hope this is true. I know He perceives the imaginations of my heart. He knows where I'm telling the truth. He knows where I'm lying. And I'm far more concerned what God thinks of what I say than I am anybody else. And that includes any man. I don't care who he is or what his position may be. I'm far more concerned that my God knows that I'm telling the truth. And what I'm going to say today as this service proceeds is going to be the truth from the bottom of my heart as I understand it. If I've distorted something as somebody else would believe from his perspective, I'm sorry about that. I don't intend to. I don't intend to say anything today that's going to malign anybody or that's going to be an attack against anybody. I'm not going to try to call any names at all and infer things that are derogatory or in any way that even could be construed to be slanderous. That is not my intention. As I said, from the bottom of my heart, I'm going to try to say what I believe has some significance in being here right now and bringing things up to the moment. And so, as I said, sometimes it's rather devious or a crooked path that gets us where we are. It makes many turns and stops and starts and perhaps false starts along the way. But that's life. And it is full of changes. As one man said many years ago, apparently the only thing permanent in life is change. I certainly have come to understand that. This morning, in trying to go through and organize my notes as to what I should say, it was already difficult enough, but the more I thought about trying to organize them and reduce them into some logical sequence, the more things I thought of, and so they just got longer and longer and longer. I literally could talk here, I'm sure, for 4 or 5 hours and not tell you the full story, so obviously I'm not going to do that. Literally, I can't tell you everything that has happened that I feel has bearing, and perhaps, at least to me, has a part in the development of the chain of events that has brought certain things to pass, even from some points of view, perhaps from a major point of view, that the Church of God International exists in the first place. That Ted Armstrong is here in Tyler, Texas, and the work is going out from here. I don't mean he is here alone. The voice, the work, the message is being disseminated places in this world, as we certainly have seen by the gentlemen who are here from Europe. But he's here. He's not in Pasadena. The last time I preached a sermon was in the auditorium in Pasadena. Similar to this, in some ways. But it's got a roof and walls, and that kind of thing. And interestingly enough, I hadn't thought about saying this, but that sermon was during the International Youth Conference that was conducted there. We had teenagers from many places in the world, a number of them from Canada, across the United States, from South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, I think the Philippines, I don't know how many places, but they were there from many, many locations. And so I talked to two or three people about what would be the best thing to say, and I decided that the thing I would like to preach about would pertain to a 15-year-old or a 14 or a 17-year-old, whether or not that person was a professing Christian, a so-called, converted Christian who had gone through the process of repentance, baptism, received God's Holy Spirit, whether or not that was true. But talk about the Christian ethics, the ethics of Christianity. Talk about the heart and core of Christianity that is relevant. I don't care whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or whether you're a Hindu or a Shinto or whatever you may be, or whether you're a totally, completely godless living anywhere in the world. And it seemed to me the place to start to do this would be to use Matthew 5 as the central theme and to build upon those beautiful statements sometimes referred to as the Beatitudes and to show what those simple, beautiful, meaningful words of Christ means in the life in a practical, applied sense to every individual irrespective of his age, his profession, his experience, or whatever. Thankfully, and I say this not as a boast, but the sermon had a great deal of favorable response from the teenagers as well as some other individuals, even including fellow ministers who felt that it was a very appropriate and a very fitting and a very significant subject. Little could I have believed, but before the next Sabbath, following that one, could come around to us, I no longer was a member of the Worldwide Church of God. Certainly I was not a minister, but I wasn't a member. I had been summarily dismissed, forcefully removed. I had gone through an experience of being pushed and shoved to be kept out of the auditorium. Things had happened to me that I could never have believed within a matter of a few days. But, again, that's the way things go. So let me, as I've tried to do, I jotted down a lot of notes. I will try to go through this in some logical, sequential order and hope that it can make sense to you. When you have your life shredded before you, it's a rather painful experience. I also want to say this, that I realize that what I'm saying today, I'm not the only one that can say. Others could go through, perhaps in a more graphic way, and perhaps more justified in terms of the magnitude or the intensity of the experiences that they have had, and say this much more fittingly than I can. But I'm talking, and I hope you'll bear with me, it's like an icebreaker. I'm talking from my point of view. It's sort of my story. And I want to share it with you just a little bit, because I think it may have some meaning. But it's a painful experience to have your life shredded, strips taken off of you. I'm not a calloused person. I'm not an insensitive person. I'm a very sensitive person by nature. Lies, distortions, misrepresentations, accusations, darts that are thrown at me that the Bible refers to as fiery darts, of undue criticism, attacks against my person, against my honesty and my integrity. The unleashed hostility of other individuals hurts. It isn't easy to take. It hurts very deeply. I would like to believe, however, that in the process of that hurt, there is a great deal that can be learned and a great deal can be profited by those experiences, even though perhaps unnecessary and certainly very wrong. But can one lie down? Can he decide that simply on the basis of the injustice that's perpetrated, either against him or against others, because of the accusations that fly like handfuls of whatever garbage one may pick up and throw, Can I lie down and quit? I had to face some decisions in my life. I said on Friday morning, January the 4th, I told an assembled number of ministers. It wasn't any particular group. It was most of the area coordinators who were in Pasadena, a number of other faculty members and ministers who lived in Pasadena, who came into my office after this push and shove meeting was over. And between tears and sobs, frustration, anger that would subside to more frustration, I tried to tell them how unjust what was taking place was. Tell them the things that Mr. Armstrong had asked me to do for him, to help him with problems that he had, and he wanted to share them with not only myself, but perhaps with others. And I told them at the end of that, and it was a sort of an expression of perhaps almost a love-hate thing. I think psychologists can understand that at the moment we say a lot of things and we make very strong statements that you may not literally mean, and an hour later when you've cooled off, you wouldn't express it the same way. I made the statement, I'm going to walk away from this building and I'm walking away from this campus and you'll never see me again. I don't care if I ever see Herbert Armstrong again. I don't care if I ever see the ministry of this church again. I said words to that effect. Those words have been distorted, spread. They've been taken out of context. I didn't mean that. Not in the sense that I have any hate toward anybody, but just an expression of my anger, of my feeling of utter and total complete rejection, and the impossibility of being able to have any kind of an audience whatever to set the record straight. And out of hurt, and very, very deep hurts that had shattered me, that was an expression. Well, for a while, I guess, in a sense, I tried to live that way. Later, I heard only in the past number of weeks, it was said by a representative of the church who went to Missouri to preach a sermon to try to say what had taken place and give the account of what was going on in Pasadena. It was very, very strongly implied that for days following my termination and dismissal, I would go and sit in the parking lot at El Rancho across the street from the Hall of Administration and have rendezvous through the day with Judge Wiseman, who was Judge Stephen Wiseman, the receiver, who they attempted to appoint as the receiver, but never really ever got installed, and finally was sort of a mutual thing. He resigned as well as being replaced. But that I would have rendezvous with Judge Wiseman in the parking lot at the supermarket across the street and spend most of my day there. I never once pulled into the parking lot of El Rancho. I didn't want to get that place. I didn't want to get that close to the Hall of Administration at that time. Nothing but bad memories. Nothing but bad experiences haunted me. Even when I had the occasion to drive by that area, I would drive several streets out of the way so I didn't see the place. And before God, as I said, whom I'm concerned about, and concerned about my attitude and my honesty, that is the truth. But that's a small point. But why it's necessary for people to fabricate, and that's all I can believe, is literally out of a big piece of rotten cloth, they can fabricate stories. I really don't understand. I don't know what's achieved by it. My wife tells me, well, you know, Wayne, why, you should take that as a compliment. You still have enough reputation, they got to work a little harder to destroy it. So if you didn't, you know, have any reputation among the people of this church and the ministry, they wouldn't worry about having to destroy you. But they've got to destroy you because you're a sort of a drawing card, an appeal. Well, she said that, I didn't. But if it's true, and I hope it is, then let them keep on trying to destroy, and I think I will try to do something to build it rather than see it destroyed. I tried to leave. I didn't want to be in the ministry. I didn't want to serve in the ministry any longer. I felt I'd served my time. I had given the best years of my life. I'd made my sacrifices. It was now behind me and over. For the remaining years, as I now approach the age of 50, for the remaining years, however long I may live them, a person who is bothered by high blood pressure has to fight and work to try to keep it in check. I don't know how many there will be. But I want to do what I want to do. Oh, I'll serve God, keep His Sabbath, honor Him, pray to Him, pay my tithes. I'm not going to rebel against God. No one can destroy my relationship with Him. But I just don't any longer want to have to think about everybody else. I would like to think about myself for a change. And that was my attitude. Through January, I was kind of like a zombie and couldn't do very much but stare at the ceilings. And then about the beginning of February, I told Doris, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a job driving. I've said for years there are two places I do my best thinking. One, sitting in a bathtub, strange as that may be. And the other is sitting behind the wheel of a car. And I felt I needed a lot of time to think. And so I decided, I called up a messenger service in Los Angeles that has cars going all over the, well, all over the area from Santa Barbara to San Diego. And I got a job, made enough money to lease or, you know, buy some groceries. It was said to me by a person who heard from another person who knows my family very, very well, and I've known this person for many, many years. It was said, well, isn't that too bad? You know, when you rebel, you really get punished. Look at CWC having to drive for a living. And so I just sort of shook my head and said, well, you know, I suppose I can see it happening. People will build upon that. And the very fact that I'm out there driving around L.A., you know, and picking up a message from a banker and taking it to another banker in Beverly Hills, or going to a lawyer's office and taking a message from him and going out to somewhere, maybe in Pacific Palisades, to give a message to one of his clients is something that, when that's the kind of work that it largely was, just driving all the time. And so let them make something out of it. I don't care. But at least I'm not fighting anybody. I'm spending my time the way I want to spend it. And I did that. And I only quit that about 2 weeks ago now. I'd gone through my process of trying to sort things out a little bit, and that part of it was behind me. But there were two or three reasons why I did that, and that does have some bearing in what I want to say. One is, I left home at 6 o'clock in the morning. I got home about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. And I was so tired then, I dropped in bed pretty quickly to get up the next morning early to be on the road by 6. Telephone calls that came in, I just wasn't there to answer. I didn't want to talk on the telephone. I didn't want to take any calls. My wife did a sterling job of answering the telephone, still is largely, of answering the telephone, all the numerous calls by the literal tens and scores, hundreds, I'm sure, over a period of time that have come in there from members, from ministers, from other people that want to wish well, want to know my side of the story, etc., etc. But I avoided all of that, as well as having a lot of time to think. I have told Ted, he knows this, we've talked about it, but how deeply I appreciated during those first weeks after all this happened that Ted didn't call me. I would have taken that call had he called, I think. I would have certainly been very strongly tempted to, but I wasn't ready yet to talk about it. And he knew that, and he was able to perceive it and appreciate it and understand it. I'm sure from even certain personal experiences of his own, he was able to understand that, and I was very grateful for that. But, you know, time is a great healer, and things began to heal. Over the past few weeks, my thoughts have been coming together, the picture of the future emerging. And a few of those telephone calls, in spite of my efforts not to take them, got through. A call from a local elder in a major metropolitan area of our nation, and some things I may not try to identify because, again, I don't want to get anybody into trouble if I can help it. But a call got through. This person, very disillusioned, very upset, disenchanted with what was taking place, didn't believe that Christianity was emanating from Pasadena. The things that were read didn't quite square with the things that he read in the words of Christ about how to treat, you know, the stranger, let alone your friends, or how to treat your enemies. Statements like, we're going to punch them out and we're not going to turn the other cheek, didn't quite sound like the words that Jesus Christ gave at a time when he was speaking to his disciples in one of the most horrible times that anyone who were to follow this newfound religion, this Christianity that he was establishing, which really was based upon the words of old, but at a time of the oppression and the enslavement of the Roman Empire, Jesus said, turn the other cheek and love your enemies and pray for those that despitefully use you and persecute you. If those words that Christ spoke to those people early in that first century pertained to them at that time, how much more do they apply in 1978, 1979, these years that we live in now, when people don't know the meaning of persecution, trials, oppression, not literally at all, certainly, in no way, a comparison to the environment and the circumstances those people lived in at the time that Jesus gave those words. I would have felt that of all the words that could have applied, the words of Christ in his early ministry were the most fitting ones. But we all know that those words were said. Anyhow, this man called and he said, Mr. Cole, we don't know what to do. We don't know where to turn. We are fearful and we are suspicious. And we don't want to be in man's religion. We want to be in the church of God. But we don't want to go through what we've just come out of all over again. And I can understand that. And I can understand their fears and their doubts. I told the person at that time that I had some of the same concerns. I wasn't ready. I wasn't sure. And so we talked, and he said, I think that there probably are 300 to 400 people, speaking conservatively, in this area that feel exactly like I feel. And if we can see hope, if we can see that there is going to be a church, that is going to be a church, it's going to conduct itself as a church, it is going to preach and disseminate and publish the message that we all believe in, we're ready to be a part of it. But we're not going to be a part of something that man is going to control and rule. And the more I listened to that, I heard that and heard it from several sources, the more I realized that God doesn't call people and place them in His work and work through them and use them, train them, bring them up to the maturity, to the capacity to be able to serve Him with some meaning and effectiveness, only for them then, out of their own personal anger or disappointment or unhappiness, to turn their backs on it and flee the whole thing. Run away from it like a Jonah. And believe me, if I could have run like Jonah, I would. Fish or no fish. But it isn't that easy. And that message got through. Other thoughts were emerging at about that time. And somewhere within a matter of days after this, Ted did call. He talked to my wife. I don't think I was there that time when he first called. Talked to her. And I don't think Ted would mind my saying this. I hope Doris didn't mind my saying it. Well, when I came home later and Doris told me about Ted's telephone call, she said, I'm mad at myself. After talking to Ted, I got on a high, and I didn't want to. Can you understand that? Can you understand how she felt? She was trying to resist this along with me and not sort of get drug into something, but listening to that telephone conversation or listening to the other side of that telephone conversation and being involved in it, she felt really up. And she got on a high, and she, along with me, realized that, well, you know, you can say you want to run, you want to flee, you had it, it's all over, said, closed, you know, right 30 at the end of it, it's finished. But it isn't. And then, of course, we knew that services were going to be conducted last week in Arcadia. I came home one evening from my driving, and I said, Doris, I'm going to go to church this Sabbath. I don't know about you. She said, yeah, I was going to suggest to you tonight that we go to church on the Sabbath. So that's the way that happened.
And so we went to services. I didn't call anybody. I didn't call the Antians. I didn't know they were going. I sort of, you know, hoped that they would. I didn't know the Fortunes were going to be there. There was no getting together to decide this whole thing. We didn't know. We just knew that we were going. That's all. And we were so delighted, so thrilled to see other people there. In the days preceding last Sabbath in Arcadia, I've sat in that car all day long, and I wrote one letter after the other. Never on paper, you understand, but I mean all kinds of letters were written in my head, and if somehow you could wire up a tape recorder to your thoughts so that you don't even have to speak the words, so I could have written some real doozies by now. But anyhow, I thought all day, because I knew, I really did know, at least in part, how Ted felt and what he feels the calling is that God gave him. And all I could do is 100% agree with it. And I thought about it, and I didn't agree just because it was Ted Armstrong, but it was just so right. But I thought through the day, even, you know, movie titles or television program titles and song titles and words and so on would come to mind, but I thought of the old TV program Mission Impossible. And what a Mission Impossible it would be if a number of those people that have been cast out, either literally cast out, as some have been, or due to developing circumstances, situations they found themselves in, were in fact thrust out by those conditions and were no longer able to fulfill their work for Christ in a ministry, in an active ministry. If those people now, as divergent as they may be in some ways, I don't frankly know what some people believe. I haven't sat down to talk to Albert Fortune. I told Albert Fortune one time, only weeks before he actually left in 1974, that he was one of perhaps a very small number, perhaps two or three ministers, that if I had a personal problem, a deep personal problem for which I was ashamed, and I felt humiliated, rightly so, embarrassed, I felt that he was one that I could go to talk over my deepest thoughts and know that he would treat me with mercy, with compassion. He would be fair, he would be firm, if necessary, He'd be loving and kind and considerate, and I also believe that he would keep it in confidence. He would trust my confidentiality. And I still believe that about Al Fortin. And I love the man and always have, and his wife, Durrance. But anyhow, I don't really know in some of perhaps the gray areas, the more uncertain areas, just what he believes. My brother Raymond is up there in Eugene. I don't know how big his church is. It's a curious thing, you know. You're unable to talk about some things. When Raymond left to do whatever he felt he had to do, I wrote him a letter, a fairly long letter. And I said, Raymond, I wish you well. I hope you succeed. If you try to actively work to cause difficulty and problems to the Worldwide Church of God, I will resist you, because I will be working for the membership of the Worldwide Church of God. But if you go out and you do your work, and down the streets of Eugene or the other places wherever you may go to serve, there are people that are brought into your church, that are brought into a relationship with God, I will wish them well and that God will bless them. I think I could probably still produce that letter somewhere. Anyhow, that was about the end of it. From there on, my dad and mom decided to go with Raymond, principally over the Pentecost issue. But it became difficult for me to even ask my parents anything about what they were doing. If I were to say to my mother, this would go back a year or so ago, maybe part of it was subjective on my part, I don't know, but this was the way that we thought. This is no insult against her at all, but it's the way I saw it, the way I understood it. If I were to say, how many people did you have at the feast last year? I got the distinct impression, why do you want to know? Do you want to know so you can publicize it and ha, 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 they only had so-and-so go to the feast? There seemed to be some negative reason why I asked any question about anything, so I didn't ask questions. I just let it go. I heard what I heard by scuttlebutt, and that was all. I didn't call Raymond to talk over what he believed, and he didn't call me. Well, I'm a little bit out of sequence in some of the things I'm going to say, and I'll get to some of the events later. But, you know, in thinking through all of the events that led up to this whole thing, I couldn't cover all of it anyhow, and I just feel that perhaps some of these things that I am saying or going to say here might be a little bit more fitting anyhow. A year ago, yes, it was a year ago. Oh, my, it's 2 years ago now. I'm losing track of time. In 1977, May of 1977, my father died. Died of a heart attack one night, very suddenly. The doctor said that my dad died the way we'd all like to die, just living one moment, enjoying life, the next moment he wasn't there. But at that moment, I had to make a rather important decision, at least to my own satisfaction. I'm not the ultimate judge. I don't pretend to be. I don't want to be, and I am so grateful that we've got a great God in heaven and his Son at his right hand, able to see and know all, and they're capable of handling the judgment, and I would much rather leave it to them. But for the sake of my own comfort and my own satisfaction, I had to evaluate to myself, what about my dad? Was my dad rebellious? Did he rebel against the Worldwide Church of God? Did he rebel against God? Did he die outside of the church? Is he in Christ? Did he die in Christ? What happens to my dad? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized why, you know, there's really no question at all. It's ridiculous. I can remember the days as a boy when people would come to our house to want to sell something on the Sabbath, and my dad would make no bones about it, no hesitation. He would say, no, I'm sorry, if you're going to come back tomorrow, maybe we'll do business. We don't do business today. Why? Well, because we worship this day as God said it. I've heard him say that on numerous occasions to people. He wasn't ashamed of his belief in God. And to the very best of his ability until his dying day, along with the mistakes that human beings make, he was obedient and faithful and loyal to the God that was his maker. And he served him with all of his heart, as much as he was able. And so he met on Monday to keep Pentecost. So did I, for numerous years. So he had some difficulty understanding that someone who had divorced and remarried may not be sinning in God's eyes by continuing in that marriage. That's what I believed for many years. And I have sat in the living rooms and the homes of people with little children scattered around the floor and seen the traumas that these people have gone through to have to separate. We all did that in the ministry of the church. But my dad, whatever, believed what he believed, and he tried to obey it. I think that's where Raymond is. And so as I was driving here that day and thinking about all this, I thought, is that so impossible? Is it so impossible that perhaps Raymond will continue to do the work that he's doing, the Church of God Eternal, based in Eugene, will continue to preach the message that he's preaching? But is it not possible that he could have a love, a respect, a tolerance for the Church of God International, for anything that I might want to be involved in? I just can't quite go and subscribe to a couple of the major things that he is saying, so I can't go and work with him. But I can accept it. I can believe that the people that are being fed and helped by that are certainly better than not knowing God at all. I don't have any quarrel with that, and haven't had for a long time. Beyond that, it's not my prerogative to try to determine and judge who is of God and who is not. I believe those people happen to be of God. Most of them. Maybe there are a few hypocrites in their midst. But no one's pulling the wool over God's eyes. So this thing of the mission impossible, then the song, the impossible dream, and the beating of the unbeatable foe, and the climbing of every mountain. And I thought, wow, what a beautiful opportunity. What a great and thrilling chance do we have. I don't have any problems in following leadership. I don't have any problems in submitting to somebody to be my boss. But as Ted has said, where it isn't quite the kind of a hierarchy that tends to impede and tends to, I think, stifle honest input, tends to create fear and repression, but where there can be the putting of the shoulders to the wheel together, the presentation of a forceful and common front to get out there and do the work and get the job done. Other than that, organization is just really not all that important. But what a beautiful opportunity that we can work together. And in asking God for his guidance, his intervention, and his blessing, that some of the names of people that I think must have haunting and nagging doubts because they're no longer involved in the work, they were such dynamic and forceful and effective people, that they may be able to work together again. And I realized right then that I really couldn't abandon my calling, but I had to be a part of it. And then because of the pleadings of other people, that after all these years, there are certain people that we look to who provide a feeling, an appearance, the example of stability. Again, I hope you understand, I'm not boasting of this, but I take great pride in the fact if anyone could come to me and say, we lean on you because we see in you stability and sincerity and conviction. That's rewarding. And every minister who's ever served, including those in this room, have had that experience. And I've had that experience. And, you know, how can you turn on that and forget those people? So I had to say, who called me? Was I called by man? Was I added to the church by any individual? Did some person give me the Holy Spirit? It's not a matter of having any problem submitting to the administration, the direction. I've never had a problem supporting the administration of the Church of God. Never. I really didn't care that much who was to do what job, so long as the job was done. It was never a problem, really, down through most of the years, to accept that Mr. Rader was Mr. Armstrong's personal assistant. I reasoned like this, that if I accept that Mr. Armstrong is the apostle of God, then certainly I must accept that he has a prerogative of appointing the people that he wishes to appoint to be his assistants and helpers. And I accepted the people that were appointed on the basis of the right, the authority, of the person or the individual who did the appointing. There were things that I thought I saw, things that seemed and appeared that weren't quite right. But I have also said this, maybe part of it's a cop-out. But there's a difference between problems of administration and problems of doctrine. And for the most part, when I saw that someone made a mistake, what appeared to me, at least, to be a mistake in administration, that wasn't the issue over which I was going to decide whether or not this was the Church of God. But if it got right down to the matter of saying, well, you don't have to keep the Sabbath, or you don't have to keep the holy days, or this is wrong, or that is wrong theologically, then that's different. Then I'm going to serve God, and God is the one who is my final judge. And frankly, there have been a number of things that have come out recently that have been said that I can't accept. I don't accept the Peter primacy. explanation of Acts 15. I just don't believe that's what it says. Now, that's my belief. I'm not insulting anybody, but I don't accept it. Neither do I accept the decision, the fact, or the idea, notion that someone else can say to me, irrespective of what I may say, never listen to me, never give me the right to explain, never want to know what I feel about it, never want to know what my attitude and relationship with my God is, can say, you should or you should not be in the ministry. I talked to a man the other night who's very close to me. I prefer not to identify who the individual is, who, along about 20 minutes into the conversation, because there wasn't too much of anything else I guess he could say as an objection, what makes you think that God called you to be in the ministry and that you should join the Church of God International? What makes you think it has to be you that is going to be there to help these people? My answer to that is, I wish I knew. I never asked to be in the ministry in the first place. I didn't want to be. I have been for 25 years, and I think certain fruits of it has been produced. So what makes me think now, after those 25 years, that I shouldn't be? That all of a sudden I should just walk away from it and leave it? So when I read 1 Peter, and I know this is all review to so many of us, but when I read 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, what Peter said to the elders, the elders which are among you, I exhort, whom also an elder, witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. He says, feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight, not by force, but willingly, and not for money, but of a ready mind. That's what I believe. I am not after security. I could have supported my family. We could have reduced our living standard. And I could have supported reasonably well on even that driving job if I had stayed with that. But I wasn't going to stay with that. I could have earned more than that. Supporting my family is not the problem. I'm not going to be working with you, with Ted, and with other ministers for money's sake. I'm not going to be forced to have to be here because I've got to be beaten down, made blind, fed to the fish, or something else to be here. After all these years, I believe there is a ministry that is awaiting to be done, a message that has to be taught, given to the world, and I want to do my part in whatever small way it may be able to be done. So as I said, it no longer became a matter of administration. It no longer became, I will go here or I will go there, but the question now was, you're not to go anywhere. There is no work for you. It's over, finished, credentials are revoked. Why? No one to this day told me why. No one has told me where I was disloyal. I have heard that I watered down doctrine. I have heard ministers stand up who are my friends that I went to school with and say, well, I never did quite agree with CWC doctrinally. They've never said, what doctrine? I would like for them to do so, but nobody has. No one has said iota, one word, to me since before I was removed from the ministry or removed from the Worldwide Church of God. I wrote to Mr. Armstrong, begging him for an appeal. I said, please, I would like to be heard by you since I served you. But if you find it in your heart not to do so, I will accept any one or more of the leading ministers in Pasadena that you would like to set as my appeals committee, and I will talk to them. Anybody. But please establish one to correct the horrible, terrible, and tragic wrongs that have been perpetrated. I followed that up with a telephone call to Tucson. A nurse answered the phone, said, wait a moment, I will go and get a message for you, came back, and apparently trying to even convey part of the message in the way the words were said, he said, no, Mr. Armstrong, will not talk to you. And the receiver went back onto the telephone, and that was the end of that. I didn't try again. I soon learned not too long after that the telephone numbers had been changed again, and so that was the end of it. Well, I thought of John. John chapter 10 and verse 1. I would like to read parts of this to you as well. These are some of my favorite words of the writings of John, the words of Christ. John 10 verse 1. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that enters not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbs up some other way, the same as a thief and a robber. But he that enters in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. And when he puts forth his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And I had to say to myself recently, is it the voice of Christ that I have heard? I don't mean literally, I didn't hear any voices, you know, nothing audible, I don't mean that. But in the analogy of the parable, was it the voice of a stranger? Has it been the voice of a stranger down through the years that I should serve in the ministry of this church? Has it been the voice of a stranger that has told me recently that I ought to obey God, keep his commandments, and teach others to do so? That I ought to teach people to tithe to his work, to support the work that he is doing on this earth? That we ought to keep the days that foreshadow and portray the plan, the beautiful plan and purpose that God is unfolding and working out here on this earth? That I ought to teach people about the beautiful and wonderful purpose of man, as I said in a sermon some year and a half ago, came to mind up in a little town of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, when a woman by the name of Mrs. Wilfong was dying of cancer. And Ron Miller, who was the pastor of that church up there at that time, read a message that day that I happened to be visiting Saskatoon. And he said, Mrs. Wilfong, thanks all of you for your prayers, for your cards and for your letters and for your love. And Mrs. Wilfong asked me to tell you that she's looking forward to seeing all of you in the kingdom of God. And those words were so moving to me that day because I had never heard it quite like that in the cold sort of facing of reality that she knew that she was going to die. Perhaps in a matter of days. She died, I think it was 14 days after that or 18 days, something that way. And she sent this message, and she'd been an example to the people that had gone to visit her. I'm looking forward to seeing you in the kingdom of God. I'm ready. Now you just hang on there and keep on and keep doing your part, qualify, so that you can get there too. And we'll all be together one of these days in God's kingdom. To me, that just sort of says it all. To understand the beauty of why God made us as human, gave us mind and intelligence, made us in his image, made us to overcome, to grow, to learn experiences by the hardships that we go through, by all that we have to endure and live, and finally to qualify to be a member of that great and eternal ever-living family of the great God in heaven. Sort of where it's all at. You may miss a lot of other things that are around on the periphery somewhere. There may be a lot of speculations that one doesn't quite understand. There may be a lot of things that he thinks he's right about and he's wrong. So what when you get right down to what really counts? Kind of like Paul said about the word love when you read 1 Corinthians 13, that you can have all the knowledge of prophecy and the great gift of tongues and have all knowledge. But if we don't understand the basic, central, elemental, very fundamental reason why God made us, how to live with our neighbor and how to express ourselves to other individuals in the service to them, and what that love of God is and the great purpose he's working out and making other members of his divine family, we miss that somehow, and we miss the beautiful words of the Beatitudes of Matthew 5. But we have great knowledge of 1,335 and 1,290 and 1,260 and 2,520, and I'm not knocking that. Certainly God can reveal, and I hope he does in his time, whatever he wants his church to understand. But we might be able to speculate on great things, but yet what have we achieved? Not very much. Anyhow, I didn't think it was the voice of a stranger that I had heard. I thought it was the voice of Christ. He says, a stranger will they not follow. Was I now going to follow the voice of somebody else? The voice of a stranger? No, I wasn't, because I think I knew the voice of the one that spoke to me and the one that spoke to you. And I think he knew me because I was one of his sheep. Now all of a sudden, after laboring and serving and traveling the routes from Pasadena to Tucson, trying to serve and being faithful, now all of a sudden, am I out of the sheepfold? Am I not one of the sheep? Am I cast out? Is it not strangers that I must listen to? This parable Jesus spoke unto them, but they didn't understand what he said. And so he said unto them, verily I say to you, I'm the door. I am the door, and you will come through me, or you won't come at all. Or if you come other than through this, you're a thief and a robber. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. And I wasn't going to listen to anything else but the words of Christ either. And I believe I know and understand basically what that message is. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Well, I won't read all of these words, but to me they're very, very beautiful words. And he talks about the pasture And he talks about the wolf that comes and scatters the sheep. And he says the hireling flees because he is an hireling and he cares not for his sheep. He says, I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep and am known of mine. And the Father knows me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one fold and one shepherd. Jesus Christ is King of kings and Lord of lords. He is going to come to this earth one day, and the kingdom of God is going to be established. And a headquarters is going to be established in the capital city of the world, in the holy city of Jerusalem. And rivers will flow out from that. The rivers of the words of life are going to inundate the world. But the kingdom of God isn't here today. And there are other pastures and other people that are to be brought in. And they may feed here and there and scattered. But they're Christ. And he's the good shepherd. And then he dispatches and sends other shepherds. Not hirelings. But he served for conviction and for purpose and reason. And they then, working for the good shepherd, the chief shepherd, are to shepherd his people. So the voice that I felt that was speaking to me didn't say, CWC, rebel. It didn't say disobey. It didn't say abandon my people. It didn't say be hateful, hostile, warring. It didn't say accuse, malign, try to destroy, repay with all the vengeance that you can possibly repay. But the voice that spoke to me said, vengeance is mine. I will do the repaying. As much as lies within you, live peaceably with all men. As much as you're able to do, don't conduct yourself like one who is full of contempt and hate and hostility and anger, warring, strife. Don't have their blood. Don't try to reap your own vengeance. Leave it to me, and I'll take care of it. That's the voice that has spoken to me. It says, love your brethren and pray for them. Even pray for those that despitefully use you and persecute you. And don't hate them. Romans 12, 18 through 21, I was going to read that, but I won't take the time. You know that passage of Scripture. That's where it says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. As much as lies within you, be a peacemaker. As Jesus said in one of those beautiful statements, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. I believe in turning the other cheek. I don't believe in punching out your enemy. But I believe that Christ is able to take care, and he will. I'm not saying by that there's not a time to stand up for your rights. I've even considered the possibility of certain legal action, but not to have vengeance, only to try to achieve certain things that I think are right and proper that should be achieved and I think would be within what God would certainly permit or perhaps want us to do to be good stewards. So there may be a time for that. I'm not talking principally about that. I'm talking about the attitude, the nature, the hostility and anger that seems to emanate. The voice that I have listened to, again, not an audible voice. I've not been hearing sounds. But that voice desires unity. A unity that I know that I've heard Ted Armstrong say he wants, that I want. I would love for nothing more than to get a message from Tucson, Arizona, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, say, Wayne, I think there are some things we need to talk about to try to correct a very foul record. I'd love to hear it. I would go. I would go tomorrow. I would go anytime. I don't know what would happen from there on, but I would go. I would want to set it right. I would love to see us in unity, working together in harmony. But as I said, there are pastures where there are sheep. And there are other sheep to be brought into the fold, into that relationship with Christ. When Elijah thought he was alone, God said, Elijah, I've got 7,000 people that didn't bow the knee to Baal. You're not alone. There are a lot of people. Paul made reference to that in Romans 11th chapter and verse 7. There are a lot of people that you may not know about, but they're my people. I know about them. You see, I am the one, after all, who is the good shepherd, the eternal of old. I am the Lord. I am the one who made, created man, placed him here, looks after him and takes care of him. I know where my people are, and I've got 7,000 of them. So don't think that you're alone.
Today, I think God may have a lot of people, and he wants a lot more. Yes, he's going to come, and there's going to be one fold, and that's in the kingdom of God. I think one of the problems that perhaps we in the church for many, many years have tried a little too hard to do, and that is try to force the kingdom of God to be on earth before Christ brought it. We tried to create that kind of a circumstance, even in times with our own children, our families. We tried to force the kingdom of God prior to the time that God knew it was right and time to bring it. So I knew what I had to do by this time. My life was dedicated to the serving in the ministry. That call, I have to obey it. I'm not rebelling against the one that I have respected for so many years. I'm simply continuing where there is forum and opportunity and obedience to do the work. If some feel that I should refuse to help, I'm sorry. If some are offended by my decision, I am sorry. But I'm here because I believe that God's Spirit is here, and I want to be here, and I want to be a part of it. I'm all for those things that divide people being buried. Hatchets, we sometimes call them. Ted has said some beautiful things the past couple of weeks that I have heard. I'm sure he said them before. I want to see politics not a part of what we're doing. I want to see unity where we can defend each other, present and apart. We don't have to worry about our backs being covered or uncovered, but we can work, brothers, as members together to do the job. While the day is here when we can work, because the Bible says the night is coming when no man can work. Now is the time for the work to be done, and I believe it is being done and going to grow and develop and will be done even greater. Now I come to, for the last 30 minutes or so, part of the story, if you'll bear with me. Some of the events that led up to early January, I've sort of told you what happened, I suppose, since early January down to now. Now I'd like to go back and tell you a little bit about some of those things that led up to early January. I really don't know where to start in this, and believe me when I say that. I've written pages of notes. The first few days after my termination, I wrote 24 pages of notes in this form. These are my own personally typed notes. Didn't edit them, didn't try to reduce them. They're very poorly typed, redundant and repetitive and long and laborious. But while it was rather fresh in my mind, I wanted to get somewhat of a record of all those events down. I got onto the 24th page and got so weary of it, I quit. I never did go back and finish it. I suppose someday I should. Maybe I'll write a book sometime, but I don't think anyone would buy it, and I would try to talk him out of it, believe me. So I think I'll just save myself the unnecessary effort. But where do you begin? I thought that I would start in a way of saying a few things here of my involvement when I began to realize that everything wasn't as healthy as I might have thought that it was. In May of 1977, and I don't want to spend very much time on some of these things because they're kind of painful, but in May of 1977, I had a couple of telephone calls. As a matter of fact, I had more than that, but I was quietly living in Vancouver, British Columbia, trying to enjoy the beautiful countryside, enjoy the work that was being done up there. But I would get these telephone calls from one or two individuals in Pasadena. One day I got a telephone call saying, Mr. Armstrong has decided he's going to make some changes. Some changes at rather high levels in the organization and the administration of the church. And Mr. Armstrong wants you to come back to Pasadena. Well, Doris and I talked about it, and we didn't quite believe it was going to happen. We just thought, well, okay, so we'll listen and we'll talk. And we really didn't believe it was going to happen. Well, a series of events took place, and we had a big dinner of all the ministers there. Dean and Marilyn Wilson had come back from Australia to visit their family, and they were in our home, and we had about 25 people or so in the downstairs rumpus room having dinner. And a telephone call came, and Ray Wright was on the other end of the telephone line, and he said, Wayne, you're going to get a telex message in a matter of an hour or so from Mr. Herbert Armstrong. But what he wants you to do is you go into your office there in Burnaby, which is a suburb of Vancouver. You go into your office to be absolutely certain that there is nobody there to receive that message when it comes in. It's for your eyes and your eyes only. So when you get to the office, then you call Henry. Henry will be at his office in Century City by this time. Now you call Henry, and Henry will transmit the message, and you rip it off of the machine and fold it up and put it in your pocket because it's for you and you alone. I thought, Ray, what kind of a melodrama are we just about to be involved in? You talk about cloak and dagger and all that. I've got 25 people downstairs or whatever. We're having a beautiful time down here. Well, this is the way it's got to be. So I went to the office. I left the party. Didn't tell them why. And I went into the office. I called Henry and said, "I'm here, Henry. You know, let her roll." And so the message came grinding through. And to make a long story short, I was to go back to Pasadena. But in the meantime, I was to go to Lake of the Ozarks for the following Sabbath and be there for a meeting. And Mr. Armstrong was going to be there, and a lot of things were going to happen. And after the telex message was finished, the transmission of it was over, Henry, with great cheer in his voice, said, "Wayne, how do you feel? You know, coming back down here and all." And this was to be international now this time. And I said, "Henry, I feel like puking." Those exact words. And he said, "Well, why?" And I said, "The very idea that anybody has got to transmit messages like this in this cloak and dagger melodrama makes me want to vomit." And that was the end of that telephone call. And that is the way I felt. And I folded it up, stuck it in my pocket. And I went back home. And the next day, Mr. Armstrong called. By that time, of course, we were now believers, say the least. But I wasn't home. He talked to Doris, and Doris was shook up by the call. Well, in another two or three days, why, that was all off, and it didn't happen, thankfully. But that was, I think, sort of the beginning of some of these events, at least in my mind. And I'm not trying to give necessarily all the details of the full sequence. Things went on for a while. And finally, Mr. Ted Armstrong made the decision in early 1978. Time is not all that important, exactly what month, February or March or so, that we were going to sort of break out of a little of the cloistered condition that we had been in. And we were going to really get out and do the work of building the church. And the administration of the church was going to be a little bit more with a council involved. The council of a group of people who were involved. And he didn't say to me to come back down to Pasadena. He asked me one day, "Wayne, what do you think you should do? Where do you think your involvement is? What do you think you ought to do? Do you want to come back down here?" And so on. And I really, by that time, I guess I did. I felt maybe I should go back to Pasadena. So I felt yes, and so we made the move. We hadn't been down there very long in early 78, a year ago now, and somewhere about the end of April or so, my family had not yet moved. Richard, our youngest son, was in school in Vancouver, and I was staying in a little resident hotel in Pasadena, and I got a telephone call from Mr. Armstrong. "I want you and a couple of other people to come to Tucson." And so we went over there, sat down in his family room, and he looked at me, and I don't think we'd done any more than say hello, perhaps just very, very brief exchange of greetings and small talk. And he said, "Wayne, I'm going to ask you a question. If I give you an order, are you going to obey it?" And I sort of facetiously said, jokingly, "Why don't you ask me something where I got a choice?" And so then he said, "I'm going to ask you the second question. If I give you an order, are you going to obey it without checking with Ted first?" And I said, "Same answer. Give me something where I got a choice." And I was being sort of, I didn't mean it disrespectfully, I sort of meant it humorously, whether or not that's the way it came across, but sort of kidding about it. I said, "Mr. Armstrong, for many years now, I've had no problem accepting you as the leader of this church, as the one who is my head and my director. And I have tried to serve you faithfully. I don't really see that what you're saying, if you tell me something, I'm to do something. I don't really feel I've got a choice." Again, I'm talking about administration. Whether or not I went into all those details at that time, I don't really remember. But I'm talking about the administration of the church. I'm not talking about, are you going to tell me to stab my wife? I didn't have to go into that. Are you going to tell me to rebel against God here and there and not serve my Maker? Well, I'm not going to do that. I didn't say those things because I didn't assume that's what he was talking about. But I assumed he was talking about a matter of taking orders and administration and direction. So he said, "Well, I have decided that I'm the president of the church. I am still the president of the church. And I am making some decisions and I'm taking over the presidency. And I just want to know whether or not I got anyone who's going to stand with me." And I said, "Well, so long as you're giving the orders, you're carrying out the direction of this church, why, you can count on my support and my loyalty." Had reservations? Fears? I can honestly say that, but I did. Whether I was wrong, whether I made some mistakes, whether I went too far,
I'll have to let God be the judge of that, and I'm not going to take the time to go into all the rationalization behind it. I'm not claiming that everything I said, everything I did was 100% correct, because I'm sure it was not. But at least that was the answer. Well, then, of course, events materialized, and the request, I guess if it could be stated that way, or the orders to Ted were given about, we want you to do just television and radio and this or that, but get out of everything else. And there were problems surrounding that. And then ultimately it came to the disfellowship. I would like to say this without naming names. I was as horrified as anybody at some of the things that were said that were later included in the letter that went out with the four statements given concerning the reason for Ted's disfellowship. I was absolutely horrified. And I said to one person, when one or two of these things were mentioned to me, I said, can you absolutely prove that? I mean, do you have documentation? Can you back that up? If you can't, then you better just keep your mouth shut about it, because what you're talking about is slanderous. It's a federal offense. Well, I was told that, yes, it can be documented. Yes, it can be backed up. Yes, we have proof. Yes, it's absolutely certain. No, there's no question about it. Yes, it's right. And so it was used. I still didn't have anything to do with that, and I can't honestly before God say that. Then Mr. Armstrong, a little later, wanted a long letter written that would be a supportive letter to him and backing up why he had to make the decisions that he made. Now, going back to the beginning of it, so far as I'm concerned, he had made his decisions before I ever got to Tucson in the first place. He didn't call me down there to ask my counsel about what he should do. He called me down there to say, Wayne, I've decided I'm going to do something. All I want to know from you is, if I do it, are you going to obey me? And that's when I said, well, I don't see that I got much choice. And so I was willing to. But he wanted a long letter now that was going to be an attack letter. And I'd gone as far as I could go, and maybe farther than I should have gone, and some things that I put in the pastor's report already. And I couldn't write that letter. I went home and I wrote a letter. It didn't say very much. I knew it didn't say very much. But I couldn't say any more than that. I took it, and it was read by two or three other people that were to jointly signed this long letter attacking Ted, really what it amounted to. And so they read my letter. They realized it was, you know, pretty weak, didn't say anything, so they wrote their own. And I was supposed to sign this, and it really was an assassination. And I just said, no way. I won't sign it, won't be any part of it, you can do whatever you want with it, but I'm not going to. And I just walked out on the whole thing. One or two of those people didn't really want to write that letter or send that letter either, and I'll have to hand that to them. But anyhow, it didn't finally eventuate. Mr. Armstrong finally backed off and said, well, okay, you don't have to do it. But later I was reminded that when I needed your help to support me, you weren't there. Wayne, I couldn't count on you and couldn't depend on you when I needed you, and you left me to stand on my own with that decision, and you wouldn't support me and back me up. I'm sorry he felt that way. I felt it was his decision in the first place, and I think he should have stood on whatever his reasons were for doing so and not necessarily depended on some of the rest of us for that kind of a documentation, as he might call it, or whatever. But I just couldn't do that. So that was the end of that. We came on down to, if I got the sequence of events right, we, a little later, it was reported to us that a visit of some people had been made to Tucson to talk to Mr. Armstrong about the Systematic Theology Project. And Mr. Armstrong was horrified, terribly upset that he had never seen this. It had been rammed past him. He had never had anything to do with it, never approved any of it, and so on and so on. I heard about this and asked one or two others to go with me, and so we made flights. And the way the flight schedules worked out, more often than not, we got home about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. But made a mad dash to Tucson, talked to Mr. Armstrong about this, straightened out some of the record. Reminded him that four of us had gone to Tucson prior to the conference of 1978, had presented to him 10 or 12 of the papers, not the notebook. We did not have the notebook, that's true. He had not seen it in completed form, but that we had presented to him 10 or 12 papers that were going to be put into the STP, explained the whole project to him backwards and forwards, what it meant, that it was in loose leaf, that it didn't lock anything in, frozen in concrete, that it could be changed. I told him who all was involved, that Herman Hay was editing, other good scholars and minds were working on the paper, and so on. And
had presented the whole thing to him. Well, no, he didn't remember any of that. He didn't remember us being there. He didn't remember us talking about the project with him and so on and so on. So that was a little bit of the background of that. And some of these events I'm mentioning only because I think they are significant in showing little by little the realization of what was taking place. I knew that time and again I would say, when words would come up about Ted or about whatever Ted would do and decisions that were made, or he'd bring up statements to me, well, you have to go to Ted. About everything I would tell you to do, you'd go to Ted. And I'd say, Mr. Armstrong, you're the one that said that you were turning over the reins of control to Ted. What did you want us to do? If you give an order and it happens to be in conflict with something that Ted has decided that should be done, do you want me to try to work out so that we know which way we should go? I would have to go to Ted and talk about this, or I would have to come to you at times and talk to you, because I couldn't, you know, do two things at one time. And repeatedly, time and again, I have said to Mr. Herbert Armstrong, do you know how tough it is to try to serve both you and your son? And he would smile and say, well, yeah, I suppose that's impossible because Ted and I are not kindred spirits, you know. And he would get on to this, and on we'd go. But it was difficult. I remember one time when a tithing booklet came out, and he saw it for the first time. He ripped the phone off of the hook and gave me a telephone call and talked to me very straight for about 10 minutes before I got a chance to say, well, as far as I'm concerned, I think you called the wrong person. But anyhow, you know, I mean, I didn't write it, and I didn't send it out, and I didn't do this and do that, though I tended to agree with most of it. But anyhow, and I told him then, it's almost impossible to try to serve in this position and get caught in this vice. But, it, you know, that's the way it was. It was very difficult. Well, anyhow, let's see. Where am I in my notes and my events as things are taking place here? One thing after the other tended to give us problems. I heard, I'm not sure what the exact date was, but I heard that Mr. Armstrong had asked three people, I believe. There may have been more, but I know of three. They were to be his scouts. They were to be his eyes and ears in Pasadena. I was appointed to be pastoral administrator internationally. For a short while, I was even vice chancellor of Ambassador College, long enough to preside at the last concluding closing ceremonies. I have a record, I think, of being in positions for the shortest amount of time. I was vice chancellor for a week or two. I was this or that for a few days. You know, that's the way it is, the way it seems to have gone for a while here. But Raymond McNair was to be one of these people, and Ralph Elgee. They were to sort of be the eyes and ears for Mr. Armstrong. To be, as I was told on the phone when I called Mr. Armstrong to question it, I did that. I called him and said, I hear that this is happening. Is that the way you want it to be? Well, I've got to have checks and balances, are the words that were used in describing it to me. Well, I don't mind checks and balances, but I just wanted to know that I am trusted to the point that you don't have to have people breathing over my shoulder to try to check up on me. I'm being honest with you. Anyhow, Raymond decided that he would like to ask me about my doctrinal beliefs. So we went to the Hilton Hotel for lunch one day, and Raymond went through a series of about six or eight of the major doctrines of the church and wanted to know what I believed. I was willing to subject myself to this. I know one or two others that wouldn't do it. They refused to allow themselves to be dealt with that way, but I thought, okay, if we can get these things out of the way, well, let's go ahead and do so. So we went down through tithing, racial relationships, holy days, covenants, I don't know, one or two more, I suppose. And at the end of that luncheon that day that lasted for two and a half hours, Raymond was satisfied that he and I essentially believed the same things, at least about the major important doctrines. And I thought that, okay, now that he has the eyes and ears, he's got the report, everything is okay, and the doctrinal differences have been settled. Now, of course, it comes out that they are still saying that they have had questions about, and that I was a liberalizer, and that I had been guilty after returning from Australia of being liberalized by some of my left-wing friends, and that I was wrong doctrinally, and they never had agreed with me, and all that kind of thing. Well, that didn't bother me all that much. So we rocked along, and to make a very long story short, we come down to about the beginning of December. Perhaps the end of November is even more importantly, where this now begins. All during this time, also it is said that there was a conspiracy. I was involved with Ted, that I was in regular contact with Ted Armstrong
telephone calls, etc., all through the course from May or even prior to that time, on down through the latter half of 1978, which is totally and completely false, even to the point that when Ted had called for me on one or two occasions with necessity, I had had to send him a letter. Raymond McNair sent a letter, and I sent a letter, which was a sort of a standard form letter that goes out after people are terminated and disfellowshipped, asking for certain information. And so a call came in. My secretary mentioned when I came back one day to the office, the call was there. I didn't return the call. Maybe I should have. Maybe I should now apologize for that. And if so, I do. I don't even know anymore, but I just didn't return the call. I was not in touch with Ted. Ted did not try to call me again. I did not call him from the time of his removal until in December, on December the 4th of 1978, a call came into the office. I was out to lunch, and the little telephone message form that was given to me said that tell Wayne that I need to talk to my father, that I have been hounded by Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes, and I don't want to go on that program, but I need desperately to talk to my father. Words to that effect was on this secretarial message. I thought about that for the afternoon of December the 4th. I wanted to call, and yet I was afraid to call in a way because of what could be distorted or construed. And so, rather than to call Ted, I called Mr. Armstrong. And I've got the notes of that telephone call here, all written down, that were made. And this was typed from the handwritten notes almost immediately after that call was made. I called and told Mr. Armstrong that Ted had called. Do you want me to return the call? If you don't want me to return the call, I won't return the call. But if you want me to, I will. I read to him the secretary's message. I said, that's all I know. And Mr. Armstrong said, yes, Wayne, I want you to call Ted. I want you to be a go-between between me and Ted. And I want you to convey a message to Ted. And then I want you to, you know, get more of what he has to say and what he wants to talk to me about. So I didn't call Ted that afternoon. I called him on December the 5th. But I called Ted then and talked to him, and I conveyed the message. If I had the time, I would tell you what the message was. I'm not sure whether Ted's ever told what that message was or not. But it said, I'll try to give the abbreviated form. Mr. Armstrong said, please tell Ted that I had to do what I did to get the church back on track. It was not a personal attack against you, but I could not let the church and the college continue as they were going. If you, Ted, will admit that you were wrong in the way that you left us and what you have done, I would be happy to see you back in the church. I love you, Ted, very much, and do not wish to get between you and God and harm your eternal salvation. End of message. Now, that was the essence of the whole thing, but, you know, it took quite a long time to say all of it, and we talked about this and that. And further in this conversation, as a result of hearing, you know, about the 60 Minutes and so on, talk about family problems, Mr. Armstrong said something to the following. What those notes mean is, further in that conversation, we talked about, he tried to speculate. Well, I don't know what Ted would say, and I don't know what it's all about. And I think I had mentioned that Dottie had indicated that she had been pressed by 60 Minutes as well, and that I realized that some things were involved with the family that may go way back. And it was in the context of that, where we talked about the family, that he said words to this effect, Wayne, I am staying alive by sheer determination and struggle. I have felt that I need to live to get this thing straightened out. It would be very easy to sit down, relax, stop struggling, and it would not be very long. I do not think that I could be replaced. And I interjected that he should not even think about replacement. But he said, Wayne, I guess it will be up to you to try. Now, I didn't take those words seriously, I want you to know that much, because I figured that they'd probably been said to maybe 3, 4, 5, or 6 other people beside me anyhow, where he would say, I suppose it's going to be up to some of you to try to carry on after me and all that kind of thing. So I didn't take that all that seriously, but those are the words that were given to me. And I gave him assurances about our support and our concern and all that. Then I called Ted and passed that message along to him that he had given to me, and we discussed a little bit more concerning Mike Wallace and 60 Minutes. Now, that, I think, is sort of the beginning point of the sequence of events that took place from there on. So I had to call him back again after the December the 5th telephone call with Ted, and then that was the end of that. I didn't hear again from him until December the 10th, On the Sunday afternoon, the 10th of December, this was the day before Mr. Armstrong left on his trip to Israel, I was doing some studying on a management accounting course that I was taking at home, and the telephone rang, and it was Mr. Herbert Armstrong. Before I comment on that call, I would like to mention that on the 9th, I think it was the day before, maybe the 8th, Robert Kuhn called me, and Robert said that he had had a telephone call from a friend who told him that John Tuitt was going to be calling him Robert. And Robert was all rather hyper about the whole thing and upset, and I'm going to get a call from John Tuitt, and I don't know what he's going to say. And we had heard, by about that time, we had heard rumors to the effect that there may be some kind of a civil action that was about to be filed. And that's all we knew about it. I had been involved in no conspiracy. I knew nothing about this. I had never heard the name Hillel Chodas. I had never heard the name Lawrence Tapper. I had never heard the name Earl Timmons. The first time I heard the name Earl Timmons, and you know, all this now means that I was in a conspiracy, I guess. The first time I heard that was about mid-December. A call came in. Earl Timmons wants to talk to you. And needless to say, I was getting plenty of telephone calls at this time. So I walked out in the reception area in the presence of about five people. One of them was Ray Kosanke, who reminded me recently that he was there and heard this conversation. And I said, does anyone out here know Earl Timmons? I got this call from him, and I'm not taking any calls from people unless I just have to. And Steve stepped out of his office. Steve Martin said, yeah, I know him. I said, well, call him, you know, and if he really wants to talk to me, well, I'll talk to him after you finished. And so Steve talked to Earl Timmons, came back to me later and said, nah, forget it, it's not necessary. And I had never met the man. I had never talked to the man. That was the only contact that there had been any attempt to have until finally on January the 3rd, when I finally saw Earl Timmons for about 30 minutes. Other than that, absolutely zilch contact. I had never met John Tuitt. To this day, I haven't. I don't know the man. I've talked to him one time on the telephone. I had heard his name prior to that time because Elbert had mentioned to me back a little earlier that his sympathies and support, I think, were with Church of God International, and that he had arranged a Bible study or something that way up in New Jersey or the New York City area. And that's all I had heard about John Tuitt. Anyhow, on December the 10th, Mr. Armstrong called. The reason for his call was the first part of it. He wanted a clarification again of what it was that Ted wanted him, Mr. Armstrong, to call Ted about. He had told me back on the 5th that he would call Ted. He said, well, I'll call him. And I really thought he might, but he didn't. Now he called again and wanted a clarification of what that call was all about. So I went through the whole thing again. Then he said, what makes Ted think that he can get on 60 minutes? And I said, Mr. Armstrong, my impression from what Ted said to me, he wasn't trying to get on 60 minutes. And so we went through this and talked about it for a little while and tried to clarify it. And after we finished with that, and he was leaving the next day, I started to say, well, we wish you well on your trip. Take care of yourself. Don't push it too hard and all that. I was trying to bring the call to a close and go back to my studies. And this is exactly right. My wife could, she's the only one who could, but she was there sort of listening to my end of the conversation and could verify it. And then out of the blue, and very surprising to me, and you could have knocked me off of the chair, literally. I mean, it just hit me, stunned me. He said, Wayne, he said, I have got a problem, which I would like to discuss with you in the strictest of confidence. And I kept it confidential until finally I had been so shattered and so treated I didn't feel there was any reason for any confidence anymore. But he said, every time I speak anywhere, Stan always wants to follow me and speak as well. I have been told that many of our members do not appreciate this practice, and I don't know what to do about it. He writes out his notes and pretty well reads from them in making his comments. Stan is very brilliant in many ways, but he is not an effective speaker or preacher. And on it went. He talked about the opportunity that Stan has had in speaking, and he said God has not called him to be in the ministry. At this point, I interjected, and I said to Mr. Armstrong that down through the years, I personally had not had any problem supporting and respecting and defending Stan. I told Mr. Armstrong what I said earlier, that it seemed to me he had the prerogative to establish his own legal counsel and his own assistance. I did say, however, increasingly, there are remarks that are made concerning Stan, and that the members see him too much up and front and center on stage. They see him in too prominent a position, and he's causing a certain amount of consternation to the entire church. And he said, well, he said, I know, he said, I've been told by ministers, he mentioned one or two by name, who I will not name here, and by area coordinators and by others, in very strong terms, that this is true, and I don't know what to do about it. He said, I have never given any indication that Stan should take over the work following me. If he were ever going to be in the ministry, I think God would have made that clear by now with the opportunities that he has had. He said, continued, I told Stan when we went to Big Sandy a few months ago that he was not going to speak that day. That's the first day that you had services in Tyler. He said, Buck Hammer had told me that if Stan were to go on stage and speak, that it might be a problem to a lot of the people there. Don't know what the exact words were. He said, I accepted that counsel, and I told Stan he was not going to speak. And Stan was very angry about it, and he has never let up on it, continuing to remind me about it. If I say anything to him very gently about this problem, he flies into a rage and he screams at me. He is very sensitive about it. He gets into such a rage that, you know, serious problems could occur, and I'm not sure even how much I should say. And like I said, you're going to knock me right off my chair, because I was just horrified and shocked that he would bring this subject up like this. Then he further said, he repeated several times how big the problem was and how uncertain he was to handle it. And I kept saying, Mr. Armstrong, why don't you go on your trip? You're leaving tomorrow. Have a pleasant trip. Achieve whatever you can. In the meantime, I think God will supply us an answer. I will pray about it very earnestly. I'm sure that others could pray even without identifying the problem. When you come back, if you would like to, I'd be happy to sit down with you at any time to discuss the problem with you. That's all I knew to say. I wasn't going. I realized how sensitive the subject was. I realized how potentially explosive it was. And I wasn't about to get drug into making statements at that point. I felt that's all I could say. He then went ahead and he suggested that I might contact a number of ministers and let it circulate around through the ministry how big this problem is, and have people write letters to him outlining how big the problem is so he could show those letters to Stan and use that as a way to solve the problem. I said, Mr. Armstrong, in all due respect, won't work. And I didn't do that. And I wouldn't do it. But before God, I lie not. I tell you exactly the truth. Every bit of this and much more took place in that telephone call. And so our conversation ended then with him leaving for best wishes for his trip, and that, you know, he could pray about it and I would pray about it. And now that he had brought the problem up and I agreed that it was a problem, we would pray about it, and I'm sure that God somehow will supply us an answer. I didn't know what the answer was. I didn't know what else to say. Well, on the 21st of December, he went on the trip. I had no contact at all. On the 21st of December, I was away. I had taken Richard and we'd gone up into the San Bernardino Mountains up above San Bernardino, try to do a little skiing. We didn't realize till we got up there that people buy chair tickets a week ahead of time for Snow Summit and places like that. And we couldn't even get within miles of the place. Everybody in Los Angeles was up on the mountain. But we had gone up there for a couple of days to get away from all this. The pressures were pretty heavy and snow was beautiful and all that. Frank Brown called from England on the 21st of December. Now, there's a little significance in this, and I'm sorry, it's 4 o'clock now, and I should conclude, but I'm only... I could just cut it off right there, you know. I mean, there's somewhat of a story behind this, because the campus in Brickettwood had been sold, and they had met, of course, in the gymnasium there for so long after it had been constructed on that beautiful grounds out there. And now, after the campus was sold, they had turned over possession of the property, but they were able to retain the use of the gym for the services for some months following the vacation of the rest of the premises. And I think that was to go on, without being technically correct, all right, right down to the exact date, I think for the calendar year of 1978. At the end of that year, they were to have made arrangements for alternative meeting place. And so Mr. Armstrong was going to, since he was in Europe anyhow, and stopping back through from his Mideast trip, he was going to speak in that gymnasium to a combined service as sort of a final farewell service in that beautiful gym. Even though they may have another meeting or two following that, it would be more or less the official closing. And people had actually come down, as I understand it. They had been bussed in. They had come from outlying churches around all over at least the southern part of that island for this combined service. Mr. Armstrong was in London, staying in the hotel. Frank Brown had been in and had dinner with him one evening and had made arrangements to go in the next morning and have breakfast. He went in the next morning and found that after he got there that the party had checked out and suddenly, you know, just left without notice and had flown back to the States. And he actually called my wife, calling for me. I was out of the city. He called and wanted to know if I had any idea why Mr. Armstrong had suddenly, with no notice whatever, decided to leave Bricketwood, or leave England, fly back to the States, was not going to be there for the combined service, and so on. Well, she didn't know, of course, anything at all, and I wasn't there, so I wasn't a part of that telephone conversation. But in that conversation, Frank Brown also asked her what she knew about the rumors that were spreading about a civil suit that might be filed. And he had heard it all over England by this time. Word was out. It seemed like there was going to be a group of members or somebody was going to be doing something. Some sort of a civil action was about to be filed. And the reason I mention that now is, frankly, I was a little concerned about why they had returned suddenly myself. One telephone call had occurred with a person whom I'd prefer not to name a few days prior to that time in Pasadena, where I had uncorked and said some things pretty strongly about how I felt at some copy that was written in the pastor's report that I felt was totally an error. And not only an error, but it was damaging. And I had sort of vented my spleen about that to this individual. And it happens to be a very sensitive subject with several personalities. So I thought maybe I'm in trouble because I had expressed my displeasure at this information, and it involved people at pretty high levels. So I was a little bit on pins and needles after his return, waiting for him to call. I knew he was now back in the States, at least, in Tucson, and thought I might get a telephone call and ask to report or something. I didn't know what it was all about. Finally, the weekend passed. Nothing happened. You know, we went through the Christmas holiday. And on December the 26th, then I called Tucson. I felt that I would be remiss to wait any longer because I was one of the few people who had the sort of the open door to call him anytime that I wished to, and I felt it was my duty to welcome him back home and ask how the trip went and all that kind of thing. So I called him on the 26th. And by the way, I might just interject, before this telephone call of the 26th, on two other occasions, Mr. Armstrong had called me from Tucson, and his opening comments were, "Wayne, I want you to immediately leave your office and go to a private telephone somewhere off campus and call me back because I don't want this telephone call to be listened to by eavesdroppers." And I think those are the exact words. That had happened twice prior to this time. So this time, I call from off campus. It happened to be Dave Antion's study that I called from because that was one of the few telephones I knew I could get to where I could be private and all that kind of thing. So I called him, welcomed him home. He went through the trip and all that. I won't go through that business. Talked about the Liberty Park and the ICCY and the square outside of that. Several things where he had been honored. Then, after we had finished that, he said, again, he brought up the same subject. That said, "Well, you know, this is a problem." He talked about Stan wants to bring lawsuits. He talked about a suit that Stan wanted to bring against Ted. And he said, I don't want a lawsuit. And I don't want that to happen. That was a concern to him. And so this was a very, very long call. Let me just get down to sort of the bottom of it here. He brought this problem back up again. He said, "It's quite a problem." And he just keeps boring in all the time. And he can really, you know, lose his temper and so on. And I don't want to upset him. And I told Mr. Armstrong that my concern was that this work, the work of God, that God had used you, Mr. Armstrong, as a leader to build, and I think God had given you His Spirit. My concern now that the work is being damaged, that Stan is in too prominent a position, in a line management function, in a position of decision-making, as well as being your counselor, and that it was a problem. And I told him, and I quoted to him a report that I had from some other ministers saying that nearly every criticism that they heard now involved somewhere in the criticism the name of that personality. And I mentioned that to him. And he replied, "Yes, that's right." And he said, "Stan seems to be deliberately putting himself into this kind of prominence." Then he made statements about the amount of money that comes in. And he didn't want to believe that anybody would serve for money and all that. And like I said, I'm trying to water down as much as I can and still convey to you some of what was said in these telephone calls. And he talked about Ted again, said, "My heart bleeds for Ted." and so on. And I referred to comments that I think were very unwise, the improper comments in the pastor's report, where it seems that people insist they must continue to try to besmirch and attack. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, I just don't think that that's what Christian people should do. He said, I don't either, and I'd like that stuff stopped. But it never stopped. I was powerless to stop it, and I guess he was too. Anyhow, I told him that I had thought about this since he had first brought it up on December the 10th, and that I would like to see him as soon as possible because I had some suggestions. And he said, well, you can come down any time. Matter of fact, he says, if you'd rather meet somewhere else away from my home, I will rendezvous with you anywhere. And I said, no, I don't feel that's necessary. I don't think we should start running around that way. You just got back from a trip. I think it's my job to come to you, so I will come to Tucson. Now, maybe we should have gone elsewhere. I don't know, but I just didn't feel it was necessary. So the call ended very warmly and with the hopes that we would get together soon. I knew what I was going to say, so the rest of the 26th and all day the 27th, I wrote a very long letter to Mr. Armstrong. That letter is here. I have a copy of it written on a large typewriter so that he can read the same kind of type that he uses in his own typewriter. And so on the afternoon of the 27th, I called him back and I said, Mr. Armstrong, I have just finished writing a letter, which I would like to bring down and have you read in my presence. It says everything that I have to say. It's a product of many, many hours of serious thought and concern and a great deal of agonizing prayer of asking God for wisdom. It's a very sensitive and very difficult area. I'd like to come and see you and have you read it in my presence, and we can talk about it there. He said, please do, come down any time. So made arrangement that I would see him on the 28th, in the afternoon of the 28th of December, which I did. I don't think I'll take the time to read all this letter, but I want to make just a few references to it. If it's in my behalf, so it's in my behalf. But more than anything else, I feel that this letter is the principal reason why that I have been so maliciously attacked. Because I dared to put in black and white some of the thoughts that I expressed concerning the work and concerning the problems that we were experiencing. Let me just read the first part of it, though. I don't think most of you would never have seen this, would you, anywhere? Never heard it, anything that way? Let me read parts of it. Dated December 27. Dear Mr. Armstrong, it has always been my belief, and still deeply within my heart, it is my belief that no thing nor any person should ever be allowed to seriously damage or embarrass the Church of God if the Church has the power or the opportunity to control the matter. Mr. Armstrong, people's lives, their eternal lives, are at stake. When any of us gives cause for offense to those babes in Christ who have been called, converted, and added to this body of Christ, doing God's work, then I believe that God will hold those who cause such offenses responsible. In Romans 14, the Apostle Paul makes this very plain. I quote verses 15 through 23. And so I went all the way through where he talks about walking charitably and not to destroy anyone else with your meat for whom Christ died. The kingdom of God is not meat and drink, and so on. And I quoted all that. I said, it's neither good to eat flesh nor to drink wine or anything whereby your brother stumbles. And so then continuing, Mr. Armstrong, the message in this passage is very clear. Even when a matter may be acceptable before God, but it's not a command, it's not an instruction that we have to obey, God tells us we are not to use that liberty to cause another to stumble or another person to be offended. Jesus was so concerned about the practice of one person causing offenses to others, perhaps some who were weak, but others who simply stumbled at the conduct of the one flaunting his liberty, liberty in brackets, or quotes, that he spoke very strongly against it. In Matthew 18, 3 through 7, we read, verily I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same as the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receives me. Then he talks about woe to the world because of offenses. You know what that says. And then I go on, before God who knows and perceives the imaginations of my heart and clearly discerns my deepest thoughts, Mr. Armstrong, I can say to you that if I ever am an embarrassment, all this is underscored, ever am an embarrassment to you, whether or not the attitudes toward me are fair and whether they're just or whether they may be totally unfounded and untrue, you should remove me from office, terminate me from the work of God, or take whatever action you deem is appropriate to correct the circumstances. And I believe that. I still, with all my heart, believe that. If I ever am an embarrassment to this church, my conduct, my behavior, And it's not repented of. I'm not talking about how guilty any of us may be. And we acknowledge it and repent and it's corrected and the blood of Christ has wiped it out and it's as far as the east and the west. I'm not talking about that. But even at times, perhaps, where I am such a cause of offense, I really feel that I should be dealt with. If ever my life, my example, or my conduct should bring serious criticism to you and consequently to God's work, not because of the truth of God's word which I teach, but for the liberties that I may take, then you should take action to correct the matter. And that's the tenor. I took a great amount of pains to go through and explain that. And then, after that, through many years of service, I have had no problems accepting and defending Stan and his involvement. He was your personal staff advisor, your counselor, your assistant. To not accept Stan was to question your authority, and I did not do that. He's been a controversial figure for years. Many people have expressed a measure of dislike and distrust for him through most of his years with the church. And I talked about even a friendship that I had developed with Stan. But Mr. Armstrong, circumstances have now dramatically changed. No longer is Stan just your assistant, your advisor. He now sits in the most powerful position in this work. Mr. Armstrong stopped at that sentence. He read it and he looked at me and he said, "Yes, Wayne, that's right." He not only speaks with all the authority that Ted had, but he also speaks with my authority. And he acknowledged that. Frankly, Stan is in a more powerful position now than Ted ever occupied. Your son Ted is no longer part of this work. In the minds of the vast majority of the membership, it was a foregone conclusion that Ted would be your successor if God did not preserve your life for the duration of this age. There was no conflict. There was no uncertainty about who would lead in the future. Now, however, Ted is gone. You've had a serious illness which nearly took your life. You're well past 86. Even though most hope and pray that God gives you life and health to finish the work, there is an increasing concern about what will happen, who will take over in the future if that should not be the way it is. Quite frankly, a very large number of members, and to be honest, some ministers see only two choices for the future. Those two choices are Ted or Stan. Though many, most actually, don't really want to leave the work. They see it, the only alternative is following Stan, and they'd rather see Ted lead the church than to see Stan do so. Now, the letter goes on. I could read it all, but this was given to him on the 28th of December. To reinforce this attitude in the minds of people, Stan is doing everything he can to present himself as next in line under you to run the work. In a purely physical way, it is common knowledge that Stan did not allow very much time to pass after Ted's departure from his office before Stan moved in. Mr. Armstrong paused and said, "Yeah, I know that, and I don't like it." That office is seen as part of the executive suite. It's almost like a symbol, the place for the man next to you in authority. And so on it goes. I'd rather not even read all this. But I talked about some of the rumors that I had heard and reports that I couldn't document and couldn't verify. And then on toward the end of it, "Also, Mr. Armstrong, I strongly urge you to have a very close look at the Board of Trustees of the Church and assure yourself that the members of the Board are people who will be certain that future responsibility and control of the Church remains with the spiritual leadership of the ministry." I was concerned that the leadership was far too much now outside the ministry. "Again, I state that anyone whose love is for the work of God and for those God has called will be more than willing to humble himself and to willingly resign from office if to do so will remove the cause of stumbling to others. If any person were not willing to do so, then let his true feelings and his true attitude be so shown. I have told you many times that I'm not seeking power. I'd like Jonah, I'd rather run," and so on. "Then my life has been committed to the fulfillment of the work God used you to build. I stand ready to do anything to assist you both now and to carry on in the future, or if necessary, to leave active service and live a quiet life in harmony with my Maker." And that one sentence there that I just read, "or if necessary, to leave active service and live a quiet life in harmony with my Maker," got more comment from the letter than any other single sentence in the whole letter. Mr. Armstrong said, "Wayne, is that what you would do? If you saw anybody trying to take over this work, you just lie down and quit?" He said, "I would expect you to stand up and fight." So, I stood up to fight. And I very soon got whatever. But he agreed with that. And wrote a letter to Stan and sent it to Stan, quoting very large sections of it, and asked Stan to resign from that position and be his assistant. Well, he called me several times again. He called me on the 2nd of January, and we talked about it further. and he told me that he had sent his letter to Stan, and Stan had read it and was very upset about it. Then he called me back again on the 3rd, and on the morning that the receiver was installed, I had gone to breakfast with Ray Wright. Ray was involved in another problem, and he wanted to talk to me about that problem. And I really didn't know that much about it, and wasn't all that anxious to talk that much about it, but I went to breakfast with Ray. We went out to Griswold's in Claremont. Some of you will know where that is. We're a long ways away from everybody. And while at the breakfast table, the waitress came over and said the telephone, or that my wife had called, and there was a message for me to go to the telephone. So I went over, and Dora said, "Mr. Armstrong is urgently trying to contact you." And she said, "I think you should hurry with your business and get back home. He seems a little agitated, very concerned, and he wants you to call him back immediately." So I went then home almost immediately, and Ray went with me, as a matter of fact. That's how he happened to be at our house during some of the events that took place. But I went back home, and I called Mr. Armstrong immediately, and he was very, very concerned that I had not told anybody about my letter to him concerning the problem and his letter that he had read to me that he had sent to Stan. And he was very, very demure and very upset about it. And so we talked about that a few minutes. And I then interjected and said, "Mr. Armstrong, just as I walked in the front door a few minutes ago, Doris was on the telephone to Pam Brubaker, who was my secretary. And Pam says that there is something very funny and, you know, strange going on the campus, that there are officials there with papers. There are police officers with sometimes guns drawn on campus. And it looks like some rather strange thing is happening. And Virginia had called, Virginia Kinniston, from down at the executive suite, had called down to Pam, my secretary, and said, lock all the doors and don't let anybody in." Now, that seemed a little strange to me, if the police are there, that you lock the doors. But anyhow, that was just sort of a superficial thought. And so I said, "This is what's going on. I don't know any more than that to tell you. Can't tell you anything more, but I want to call over right away and try to get more information. Perhaps I can call you back." He said, "Well, you better do that, and I'll call Stan." So, anyhow, I did. I called, talked to Steve Martin, and got more information. I told Steve, "Well, if anyone comes to your doors and shows legal right why they have the court's order to enter those offices, you open the doors and let them enter. Otherwise, why, just sort of hang tight and don't worry about it, and we'll see what takes place." And then later, as it eventuated, I had Steve and Art McCarro and Herman Hay, who happened to be with Steve at that time, in his office, come out to my house. I didn't want to go over there. I had known nothing about this receiver being appointed. I was not involved with him. I didn't know it was going to happen. Now it's being said because I guess when they got out of the elevator, they turned first and went down to my office looking for Stan. And they made a mistake and turned the wrong direction. But now I heard on the tape of what was said in the church service back here in Missouri not long ago that there is significance. So when they got out of the elevators, they went first to my office. But I wasn't there, so if there's any significance, I sure blew it on that one somehow, because I was at breakfast with somebody else, didn't know any of this business was going to happen. And so as the day eventuated, then let's see, there is so much to the whole thing, but about that time, a telephone call came to the house from Joe Tkach. And Joe, first of all, talked to my wife, and he insisted that he talk to me. I talked to Joe, and Joe said, "There's someone here that I really think you should talk to, and his name is Earl Timmons." And I said, "Joe, I don't have time to talk to anybody right now. I've got plenty to do right here." "Well, I really think it's important you talk to Earl Timmons." And he called back the second time, insisting that I talk to Earl Timmons. And I finally said, "Well, okay, Joe, at 11:30, I think it was, or maybe 12 o'clock, I'll meet you at the Denny's restaurant, the Grand Avenue exit off of the 210 freeway. And we'll talk for a few minutes, but that's all." And I said, "I want you there, Joe, and I want Steve Martin there. I don't want to be with Earl Timmons by myself. I could see this whole thing, beginning to shape up. And I want you to be there." So they came out. And then Robert called about middle of the morning, and he said, "John Tuitt's on the telephone, and John Tuitt knows that you're one of the few people that can get through to Mr. Armstrong, and he wants to explain to you exactly what's going on campus, and he wants you to convey a message to Mr. Herbert Armstrong. He's going to be calling you right away, and he would like to have it to be a joint conference call with Dave Antion as well, because he has respect for Dave Antion." So what am I to do? Say, "Well, no, I won't talk to the man. I want to know what's going on, and I wanted to report it to Mr. Armstrong." So we set up the call. The call came through. I took copious notes, and John Tuitt, without much interjection from me, went right through the whole story and said, there is a receiver being appointed on campus right now. We have already gone to the judge, and the judge has granted this receivership, and there is to be a complete audit that performed, and so on and so on. I went through the whole thing. He said, we love the church, we love Herbert Armstrong, and we don't want to destroy the church, and we want you to convey this message to Mr. Armstrong that if he were to make some changes, that we would withdraw this whole thing. Well, I wasn't telling him, I wasn't advising him, I wouldn't say you should or shouldn't have done it. I frankly feel that the receiver being appointed right at that time was one of the very bad steps that was taken. I think it would have been better had it not happened. We were working. I don't know, I don't think that would have really borne that much fruit, but at least it was a small little step. I would have liked to have waited and seen just what happened. But that all got blown by the appointment of the receiver. Anyhow, as it turns out, after talking to John Tuitt, I felt I wanted to convey that message to Mr. Armstrong. I wanted to also tell Mr. Armstrong that it seems to me that if we've got the law by court appointment, and they can produce papers to come out here and to appoint a man to sit in a chair behind a desk in this office for a while and look at our records, that we sure look awfully guilty when we lock the doors, peer out from behind the curtains, and look like a bunch of scared little boys who are all guilty. And I wanted to tell him that. And not just tell him over the telephone, but tell him very forcefully. But if we've got nothing to hide, then let's let them see. I don't want a receiver. We don't want this work taken over. But we want it to be clean and honest. So Dave and I, Ray Wright wanted to go because he wanted to talk about something else of his own. And Herman Hay went to Tucson on January the 3rd. The time we got it, well, we flew over actually on the G2. And because Ed Black was getting that out of Southern California before they slapped some sort of control on that. And so we flew over there, went to see Mr. Armstrong. It's also reported, by the way, that I asked and demanded to meet him somewhere else. Actually, it was another one of our party that recommended that Mr. Armstrong meet us away from his home, because he himself had suggested that on one or two occasions in the past. It was suggested it might be better to do that. And so I had said to him on the telephone, would you mind meeting us at the Marriott Hotel? Well, he didn't want to do so, but he said he would. And when we arrived at the airport, there was a message at the airport to call him, so I called him from the airport, and he said, Wayne, I just can't go out tonight. You got to come here. And I said, fine. Didn't bother me any. It wasn't my suggestion. It was somebody else's anyhow. And so we'll meet you there. But now that's blown out of shape, you know, that everything is, so won't worry too much about it. But we went there, and we talked for quite a long time, and finally he agreed with us that we should not appear guilty, that we should cooperate. He couldn't quite accept John Tuitt's report that John Tuitt was concerned about his welfare, and I could see how that was difficult for him and all. But finally then Dave suggested, brought up, Dave said, Mr. Armstrong, I think you should appoint Wayne Cole to be the chief acting officer. Someone in Pasadena needs to be able to make moment-by-moment immediate decisions with what's going on. He can stay in touch with you, but you've appointed him already to, you know, almost that kind of a position, so you should appoint him to this for this crisis. Now, I didn't bring that up. I even feared the position. I told him, and Herman Hay could verify this if he would. Dave can, and Ray Wright can. But I said, Mr. Armstrong, if you do that, when finally he was indicating that he was going to, I want you to make, who are going to construe this as some sort of an underhanded way that I have sort of wormed my way in to be the successor. And I don't want that to happen. And so I want you to make sure that you cover that this is temporary. And so he wrote then his appointment of me. While that was being written, and he typed every word of it himself, and it was at about 10 or 10:30. It was not at 3 o'clock in the morning. We had a 1 o'clock flight from the airport to fly back to Los Angeles after that, and we made that 1 o'clock flight. But at about 10 or 10:30 or so that night, he went into his study, and he typed it. Herman and Dave helped him word it. I went outside. I was sort of shook by this whole thing, and it was warm and stuffy in the house, and I went out into the night air and took about a 30-minute walk up the streets around his place. I was not there when it was written. I didn't say one word of what should be said. I didn't want to be there. I didn't ask for it. I wanted him to be sure that it was what he wanted to say, and I tried to say all that to him. It was all typed, completed, and by the time I got to the house, they were all at the front door and ready to leave. It was all signed and completed and done. And so they were at the front door. We got in our car. We drove back to the airport. The next morning, I did not go on campus. I went to a hotel so we could call the press and issue these press releases, since he wanted it done as a press release. And then about noon, I called Stephen Wiseman. And that's the first time I had ever spoken to Judge Stephen Wiseman. I told Mr. Wiseman about what Mr. Armstrong had just done and about the appointment. I apologized and said, if you've had any rough treatment, I am sorry about that. That we did not ask for the receiver. I don't know what really is going on, but now that you are there, we are anxious to cooperate and dispose of this unpleasant business as quickly as we can. And he was excited about hearing finally from somebody that someone could be civil. And he said, I'm having a meeting at 12 o'clock. Would you come to the meeting? And I said, sure. I called Ellis LaRavia and I said, Ellis, Mr. Armstrong has made this appointment. From now on, please, let's cooperate. Tell the people to open their doors, go back to work. Let's get this thing back to normal. Let's stop looking like we're guilty. We will dispose of whatever we have to, but let's just go on and let God fight this thing and get our work done. And he reluctantly agreed, but he did agree that that's what we should do. I called Raymond McNair. Raymond said, that's good. I believe that was right from the very beginning. I had told the people in the college I should cooperate, so he was pleased. And then I went to the 12 o'clock meeting. At the end of the 12 o'clock meeting, Herman Hay asked a question of Judge Wiseman. Herman said, Mr. Wiseman, what would happen, this may not be quoted word for word, but it's very close, what would happen if Mr. Armstrong last night didn't really have the authority to appoint CWC to be the chief executive officer, acting executive officer? Judge Wiseman, whether or not he was sharp enough to really get the implication of that quickly, and it seemed to me on reflection that the question was a legitimate question, because technically speaking, the receivership had been appointed already prior to Mr. Armstrong writing this appointment. Now, you get into a law court where they argue the technicalities of things. It looked to me like, you know, there could be some technical concern about the legitimacy. Judge Wiseman immediately said, I have thought about that. And he said, irrespective, whatever, not only has Mr. Armstrong appointed Mr. Cole, but I also want Mr. Cole to be in that position. And that was all that was said. Now, whether or not that was the time, but that was the only time in my hearing, and I was around there for some little time after that, Judge Wiseman never made one statement about firing Herbert Armstrong. Never made one statement about being concerned about the ecclesiastical affairs of the church. We went to lunch after that meeting was over, and we talked for about 2.5 hours. Went back to the office, and I talked to him till 4 o'clock. And all the words that we talked about for about, 4 hours or so total were, and he kept repeating this, I want you to understand that a receiver is only for this and that purpose. I am here to supervise for the purposes of an audit being completed and taking temporary charge of the assets until this can be done. I don't want to be involved in, I in no way am trying to challenge Mr. Armstrong's position. I want nothing to do with the ecclesiastical affairs of the church. That's entirely in your hands, Mr. Cole, for you to contact Mr. Armstrong and so on. That was repeated and repeated and repeated over and over and over again. Nobody could have misunderstood it. And yet that, as I read it, is sort of the crux of the whole thing. That the receiver came in and these people came storming onto the campus, and out went Mr. Armstrong and out went the ministry and out went everybody, and I'm in charge. That sure isn't what was ever told me. Never. You know, I also sometimes wonder that if someone comes up to somebody, you know, stomach to stomach, and begins to push around on them and say, get out of here, you know, you're of the devil, you're not this and you're not that and you can't do this, that he might receive just a little bit of sort of a brusque reply. And I could imagine that Judge Wiseman and a number of other people might have replied in kind and may have made a statement to the effect, I don't know, I'm just speculating, but might have made a statement, well, I'll tell you, I do have authority around here, and I am going to come on this campus, and we are going to do so and so. Whatever he might have said. I still can't conceive that. He's a very gentle. He has a sterling record as a judge, now retired, some 30 years or so, a judge of the Superior Court in Los Angeles, and a very fine gentleman. I just couldn't see him ever making a statement that he'd replaced Herbert Armstrong or fired him. I just don't believe it. Certainly not in my hearing. But that's the way it was purported to be. Well, I think most of the record from there, Friday morning we had a push and shove meeting and we got sort of pushed around. But then on the Sabbath, Mr. Armstrong had apparently made it clear, even before the services on Sabbath afternoon, there would be to be no disfellowships. Had said that no one was to be disfellowshipped. But then during the service, a gentleman came back from Tucson, came into the auditorium, and announcements were made at the conclusion of Rod Meredith's sermon that I, Dave Antion, Robert Kuhn, and Ben Chapman were to be disfellowshipped. So we were. But on a Friday, Mr. Armstrong had said no disfellowships. On the Sabbath morning, he had told Ellis LaRavia that, I am told, that there were to be none, but that had all been changed by the persuasion of others, or another one at least, and that all got changed, and I was out. So on Friday, at about 11 o'clock or so, I had a meeting in my office, as I referred to earlier, with area coordinators, ministers, anyone who wanted to come in there, sort of a reaction from that very difficult meeting in the auditorium. And that's where I told them, I have served, I have tried, I have done my best, I have given everything, I didn't ask for any of this, I'm not a conspirator, I've supported Mr. Armstrong, served him faithfully, I've tried to carry out his wishes, I would love to see this church go through this storm right now, and I think that even though we didn't ask for this, but if we can go through this kind of an audit, and we can come out on the other end of it with a clean bill of health, because either we are clean or we cleaned up what wasn't clean, this could be the rallying point for this church, and I still believe that. But it wasn't to be that way, and I just told them, I am going home, and as far as I'm concerned, probably you'll never see me again. And that's what I meant. And I didn't bother anybody. I didn't fight. I didn't write letters. I didn't have meetings. I didn't make telephone calls. I just did my own thing. And now here I am with you, and I'm going to stay here. If I don't get kicked out somehow, I'm kidding. And I'm going to serve, but there has been no conspiracy. The closest thing that could be called a conspiracy would be that Mr. Armstrong called and said, I've got a problem and I need help, and would you get some other ministers to join with you and write some letters and help me deal with the problem, if you want to call that a conspiracy. That's the closest thing to being a conspiracy that took place at his request. But I'm not calling him a conspirator. I think indeed he had a problem. I think he saw it, in part at least. And I think he was sincere. And he'll have to answer for himself what the reasons are for reversing that. But he told me on the phone at least four or five times in telephone conversations, when I was a little goosey, I can tell you. And by the way, I did record three different telephone conversations. That's the only telephone conversations in my life I ever recorded. I did not record December the 10th, the first one, had no reason to, nor any call ever before that. But because of the sensitivities of the problem, there is something in the statutes, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to argue about just exactly what it says, but there is something in them to the effect that if you have reasons to believe that there could be some kind of action or whatever brought against you, you under some conditions, can record for your own protection. And I think I'm going to go back to someone and get more information on that. But anyhow, I did record three conversations, but I did not use it against Mr. Armstrong. Any use that has been made of those recordings or other recordings which were not mine, and I think that's very possible, was done by somebody else and not by me. I have not used them, and I'm not responsible for them being used. So anyhow, I guess of that I have to claim guilt. But otherwise, as I said, I'm not a conspirator. I don't believe in that kind of thing. And I just, so hate to see what has taken place to the church. I hate to see what's happening to Mr. Armstrong and the ignominy that I think is surrounding him with all this attack that's taking place against it. In his years, when he ought to be able, in the last years of his life, he ought to be able to sort of look back with gratitude, appreciation, and with joy, and with beautiful memories of all the good things that have happened. Rather than that, it's got to be, with great distress, great concern, and a certain amount of shame that all this kind of thing has to circulate and has to said, and this is the report, and this is the, this is what is heard. If anyone thinks of the Worldwide Church of God, it's this kind of thing that's going on that they think of. I think it's tragic. But the work of God is going to go on, and it's great to be involved where it can go on. Nice to be with you. You'll be hearing more later.
Thank you, Wayne. I think all of us understand the unusual circumstances mean that this is not the normal kind of a Sabbath or a normal sermon, but Mr. Cole certainly filled a lot of very large missing gaps into my own mind that I had never known before, including the call that he got up in Canada clear back in 1977. And that jives exactly with Mr. Fortune sitting across and telling me the other night that not only did my father call him to Monty's restaurant in May of 1977 and beg him to come back out of complete obscurity, out of, if you will, disfellowshipment as being a non-member since 1974, and take over from me without ever telling me that he was doing this, never telling his own son, what is the problem? Why was he dissatisfied? But he was doing the same thing with Mr. Cole. In other words, while I don't accuse my father, I'm merely saying that for whatever his reasons, his fears, his insecurity, his feeling of possible retaliation from Mr. Rader, whatever they were, his motives, he was far more actively involved in a conspiratorial sense of calling other people and soliciting their aid in ousting me when all he really had to do was pick up the phone or write me a letter or call me to Tucson and say, Ted, you're out, than I have ever remotely been. I would not have dreamed. I used to make my rusty bayonet speech to Wayne Cole. And I said, with a rusty bayonet halfway through my heart, I would never lift up my hand against God's anointed. I would never try to put my father out or in any way try to take over from him. Something occurred to me, or I wouldn't be standing here and saying something as an addendum. Never have quite seen it this way before. I know more deeply now than I've ever known that my father is in an agony of worry, of fear, and of apprehension. That he's got a problem, and it's a big problem. And he is frightened because of the influence around him. He has made almost plaintive gestures calling upon other ministers, including Mr. Cole and myself, to help him get rid of that problem. Maybe it was because some of us were a little too weak. Maybe it was because our dogged determination not to in any way go against his wishes and to be almost in servility, humility, in trying to remember chain of command, we didn't correctly interpret his plaintive calls, help me neutralize, help me isolate, help me move Stan Rader over here and diminish that man's power over me. We were timid. We didn't correctly interpret his plaintive cries to help him do that. And so, Rader's hold is more powerful and stronger on my father than it has ever been. Now, what was occurring to me, as Mr. Cole was speaking, was merely this. The entire remaining membership of the Worldwide Church of God knows nothing about what I've just said or what you heard from Mr. Cole today. They are of a 180-degree different opinion about the receivership, how it came in, what the state is trying to do, and the why and the wherefore, and they see Herbert Armstrong and Stan Rader just like that as being totally supportive of each other, rather than my father terrified of what that man may do to him. Every dime, every dollar that the Worldwide Church of People doggedly and zombie-like continue to send out there to feed that grotesque monster keeps my father in that position of fear and terror and the nightmare of control underneath Rader 1 week, 1 month, 1 year longer. I don't see this as a desire on my part to have the assets or the power or the people or anything else at a Worldwide Church of God. But I'm seeing now that the longer they feed it, the longer they put food into a body with a gigantic, unbelievable, thousand-mile-long tapeworm that is sucking and leaking its strength, the longer the people keep it alive. How long are they going to support what I feel is an absolute monster that should not continue to survive? The work of God is alive and well. That Plain Truth magazine has got some great articles in it. I can't take issue with everything. Some of the articles that are a little political, I do take issue with. Much of what is in that magazine is fine. When they stay off the controversy and they don't try to beat me over the head, the Good News magazine is fine. The things that are in there are true. There is a work being conducted here in Tyler. It's a shame that it isn't one work. I read yesterday about a 30-page summarization of a meeting that I had with Mr. Cole and all of the area coordinators in single-page typewritten memoranda that someone had placed on my desk. I don't know where it came from. I hadn't seen it in about a year. I could stand here and preach those very same words today. It was about the growth of the church. It was about our clear identity of letting people see who we are, of being proud and pleased and happy with our message, about how ministers rarely get so excited in the pulpits that they really let fly with the kind of power that they should, of how we tend to hide our light, that ministers don't say, if you knew who he is that speaks with you, you would have asked me because I have living water to give, that we're ashamed, we hang back, we hide our light, we try to put ourselves in a framework of a college or an educational institution instead of a church. Every word of that rang so true, and I was so amazed in reading it after this amount of time. And I remember telling Wayne, I said, Herbert Armstrong has never surprised God. He surprised the daylights out of me a few times, but he's never surprised God, I said. And I told all of those men at my father's deepest illness, if I cannot set you the most glowing example of honoring my father, of upholding him and respecting him, now, at this crucial moment in his life, how in the world could I ever expect any of you to ever give any loyalty to me? Because loyalty is a two-way street, and I'm sure that they and all the area coordinators remember that. I've heard from a man who, at the expense of a deep and a close friendship between himself and me, remained loyal to my father when that loyalty was pulling and tugging at other loyalties, but his loyalties to my father were absolutely impeccable. I was a casualty, and Wayne Cole wrote letters which came out in the pastor's report doing exactly what my father wanted him to do, even quoting what I said in a sermon in Rochester, if I leave, don't follow me, etc., doing the job he was told to do as loyal as he knew how. I know, certain knowledge, that the only conspiracy he was ever involved in, if you want to call it that, was the conspiracy that Herbert W. Armstrong masterminded. In asking Wayne Cole and in asking others, please help me get rid of Stan Rader. That's the only conspiracy that either I or Mr. Cole or anyone else have ever been involved in. Well, this has been a very rather exhausting occasion in one way, because it takes me back. It filled a lot of stuff into my head that I'd never even known before. I'd never heard Mr. Cole's letter to my father. I didn't know about his calls to him up in Canada. But I'm very thankful that it's been given in front of all of you people. I'm thankful that the tape recording is available for the tape program, and I'm thankful for Mr. Cole's spirit and attitude. I've not heard him say one word against Herbert W. Armstrong. I've heard him honor my father and speak highly and respectfully toward him. That's what I will do. It's what we all must do. It's what I intend to continue doing for the rest of my natural life, and so long as my father lives and long after he is gone. So let's all understand what the real problem is and direct our prayers in that direction, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against wicked spirits in high places. And it is not by might or power or by numbering Israel, by the number of people or the size of bank accounts or physical facilities, but by my spirit, says the Eternal. The spirit of meekness, of goodness, of gentleness, and of faith, and the spirit of love, because love does cover a multitude of sins, and love is the greatest power on the face of this earth. Thanks very much, Wayne. Great to have you here with us. And we'll all be dismissed now after the song service. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you very much, Father, for the liberty in Jesus Christ that you have given us, for the calling that we have. Thank you, Father in heaven, for your mercy, for your love, and your spirit. And thank you especially for the way you are dealing with those whose lives have been shattered. And we remember the thousands of bewildered and frustrated people in your church today who, because some of their leaders are losing sight of the very simplest part of your holy word, the fifth chapter of Matthew and other places in your word that are such beautiful and gentle reminders of the way we are to treat each other, that people are being kicked out of fellowship with dearly and beloved friends merely through a Xerox or a copy, with never the care that someone ought to show a crippled person hit by an automobile along the roadside. And Father, as Jesus said, forgive them, they know not what they do. Help us to strive toward the attitude of a Stephen or a Philip, the attitude of the Apostle Paul or of Jesus Christ himself, who even at the very moment of deep pain, of physical affliction, and near his own death, was able to say those words and to mean it. Father, lay not this sin to their charge. They are sinning. They are sinning against us and are sinning against some of your own little people in the church that is your body that you have used, to call them to a complete new way of life. And yet that very body, that very church and its leadership are turning angrily with teeth like knives and devouring some of the little ones. Help them, Father, and strengthen them and be with them. And help people not to become so discouraged they just give up on you because they get disgusted with people. We do thank you now for the opportunity on this Sabbath day, for the encouragement that we have heard. Thank you very much for Mr. Wieserbeke, Mr. Bourdain, and for what they said warmly to give us greetings from the brethren in France. We ask your blessing and your inspiration over them and your protection as they return back to their homeland, and for the brethren there in France and Europe. We ask you to be with them because many of them are going through identical trials and similar problems in their own lives, very bewildered and distraught, knowing not where to turn. We ask you to be with those who will be traveling many distances now, that will be going back up to Arkansas, over to Fort Worth, up in Denton, and to put your angels about them and guide them and protect them. Thank you for this Sabbath day, and we commit our lives into your hands in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.